Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. I'm your host, Joe Nathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
Hola.
And Guillem Villette.
Maybe.
And Han Lindman.
Hey, it's me, Han Lindman.
So we have an excellent show coming up for you today. A little bit later in the episode, we're going to be doing a little bit of news analysis. We do this every now and then. There's been so much stuff going on the past couple of weeks. We've got some Nintendo Directs, I think multiple at this point.
Who the hell knows?
Yeah, I don't know. They just kind of pop up all over the place. We've got MPD sales data that is really needs to be discussed, and the PlayStation 4 announcement, which just happened yesterday. So that bears some impact probably on Nintendo and the Wii U. And it's just an interesting thing to talk about. So we'll spend a couple of minutes. Don't worry, not the whole show. But I like PlayStation. I want to talk about it just a minute. And we might even have time for a couple of emails. So we'll see. But first up is new business. And actually, I was hoping John could go first because he's got some fucking new business.
I do have some fucking new business. To start off with...
That sounds so sanitary.
To start off with, I did actually pick up To the Moon. It was on sale on Steam for $3.39. So after hearing the glowing reviews of it, I decided to, and also the fact that it was about 3 hours long from what I recall Johnny saying.
It's bite sized.
Yeah, I really was really interested in it, so I picked it up and I really like it so far. It reminds me of the old 16-bit Super Nintendo RPGs.
You get the Chrono Trigger, right?
Final Fantasy 3 for me, buddy. Come on.
Okay. Yeah. But I mean, now that you've played Chrono Trigger, I'm sure you can also see the influences.
The cribbed art style.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the art style, of course, but also the use of music is incredible, which is one of the things I think I miss overall generally in games nowadays is that music is just, I feel like most of the time it's just a checkbox. Like, you know, oh, well.
We need some Derizza in here.
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know. This is an epic scene, so, throw in some drums and, you know, just make it sound epic and whatever. And people don't really care about music very much, but very seldom do you actually, you know, encounter a game where music is one of the focal points in trying to, you know, pull kind of feeling out of the player, like making the player connect with, you know, his kind of like in-game characters and stuff like that. And To the Moon does that really, really well. It's one of the main things. I mean, right at the very start, there's two children playing a song on a piano. So music is very much a central theme of the game. What songs mean to the characters, why they wrote a song, and kind of like it's part of the puzzle that you kind of figure out as the game goes along. You find out, you know, okay, well, this song was written. Why was it written? Who was it written for? Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I love when games have characters who play music in the story, and that music actually becomes part of the soundtrack. And I think it's one of the missed opportunities that Nintendo's had, like with Zelda, ever since Ocarina of Time, because they make the character playing a musical instrument a very key part of the game in almost every Zelda game since then. Mm-hmm. And yet the songs that you play aren't really part of the soundtrack. I mean, maybe a little bit with, the girl in the forest in Ocarina, but for the most part, you're just playing these kind of little diddly-doos and then something magical happens and then it goes back to whatever was happening before. Yeah. And that's the great part about To the Moon is that these characters are playing music and it's part of the story, but then the songs that they play, they form the backbone of the soundtrack, and it's so beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I thought of that when we were playing through Majora's Mask. Was even just playing the ocarina, it was interesting because it had been so long since I had actually used music to any effect in any game that I'd played. Now, granted, I play a lot of first-person shooters, so
I mean,
if you consider gunfire music to your ears, then I suppose
if you
that'll
had
work
played...
for you, but.
If you had played Guitar Hero Modern Warfare Edition, you'd be fine.
you know that's coming up. It's going to be on the PS4, I think. But
if you'd played Devil May Cry 3.
You would have been fine because you would have played Devil May Cry 3.
but yeah, I mean, I feel like it's often overlooked. And I think that, you know, a lot of what games tend to try to do through, you know, some sort of graphical enhancement or something like that often can be done in a much more effective manner with just music, especially like, you know, I was laughing at to touch on the PS4 stuff for a second. I feel like in every single console reveal, they're always like, this is going to be the console where you can actually see what your characters are feeling.
Well, yeah, but they did mention the word emotion 4 times in rapid succession. It's like always, which, if you followed the industry for a while, will give you a nice playback to the PS2's emotion engine.
Yeah, exactly.
Which let you see how players were, or their characters were feeling with their statically painted face. But if you recall, they did talk about it took 16 million polygons to make this old man cry.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, I find that a lot of that stuff is much more effectively, you know, communicated with music. I mean, if you look at To the Moon, its graphics are, you know, crude when you look at games today, like modern graphics engines. But it's, you know, the characters are simple enough that you look to kind of connect with them in different ways, and the music is a really great way of doing that. Yeah. So, you know,
writing is excellent too.
Yeah, the writing is absolutely great.
It's really hard for something that obviously is hard to see because, I mean, not only are they, you know, they're small characters, but the angle that the whole game is, I don't want to use the term shot from, but that you view the game from would actually make it really difficult to see faces anyway.
Yep.
So they don't even, you do it more through pantomime and through environmental cues, color palette, sound effects, music, writing. It's a lot more of a conditioned thing than just, I am sad. Look at this CG tear going down my face.
Yeah.
I think the problem with doing that, though, is I mean, you do run into the sort of uncanny valley feeling that you're like, yeah, he's crying, but he looks kind of weird. And it's a lot easier to avoid that because your mind wants to connect with these characters, and things like music put you in the right state of mind to do it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, the characters in To the Moon, they aren't realistic enough for me to look at them and say, oh, well, they're not human. You know, like, they're unrealistic enough for me to, you know,
You know they're not, and then you move past that, and you actually start to connect with them anyway.
Yep. Yeah. So it's very cool. Some of the things I kind of dislike about it, I find that the puzzle solving in it is just sort of kind of pointless.
They're not even really puzzles.
Yeah,
it's more like walk around and click on everything.
Yeah, and I kind of felt like they were just kind of thrown in there to make it more gamey, which I didn't really see the need for.
Yeah,
like,
they're not good.
Yeah,
They're bad.
They just seem like kind of an out of place game mechanic to make it seem like more of a game. So
you mean like the sliding tile stuff?
Yes. Yeah, like where you flip the tiles to reveal the items.
I think by the end, once you kind of learn the rules of it, it becomes so easy that by the end you don't even think about it. It's just it's just something that you do.
I think that makes it worse.
But it's a very tiny part of the game.
Yeah, it's a very tiny part of the game. But to me, I think it just gets in the way most of the time.
As an adventure game fan, although that's a very difficult thing to be in 2013. You know, it's not a great adventure game, which. I mean, it's great at some of the things adventure games are really great at. Adventure games are, or at least should be, really great at story delivery because that's primarily all it is. It's a story delivery conveyance.
Yeah.
But as an adventure game where you have to a certain extent, explore your environment, it's not very good. Most of the things you need to click are just brightly colored right on the screen.
Yeah.
Or stand out in a relatively Spartan landscape of non-popular
areas. Look for the massive magnifying glass.
But... They just don't always seem like they have a lot of resonance with the story either. I mean, the objective is you collect these items that relate to the history of this person. But many times they just seem like they're random items strewn about the level, and maybe one of them really has a huge difference. But a lot of them are just kind of like, whatever.
Yeah, it could be anything. They just happen to make the character like
this. He really liked fruit salad.
Yeah, and he really likes pickled olives.
Okay. It's pickled olives, yes.
Yeah, and there's no context to why pickled olives are important, but
I think it feels like that mostly in the beginning, and as the game goes on, you start to learn why these things have a meaning to the character. And so over time, some of the objects pop up multiple times throughout the timeline that you go through. And as you get earlier and earlier and early in his life, because the game goes backwards, you know, and you're going through his memories as he gets younger and younger, these objects that you've seen before, but you didn't really understand why they were important to him. Later in the game, when you're visiting him as a young person, you start to realize where these stories, you know, spawn from.
Yeah.
And I think it's more affecting, but at first it can seem a little silly for sure.
I mean, overall, I think it's a really good game. I mean, if you can pick it up and, you know, you have like an afternoon to play through it, it's completely worthwhile.
Yeah,
like, I mean, it's certainly one of the most affecting games I've played in quite a while. So,
well, just wait, buddy.
Yeah. Yeah. I got the Kleenex, buddy. I'm going to start that.
Nice.
Too much information.
Hey, nicely man, it's for the one manly tier that I'm going to shed. All right, Guillaume, so get your mind out of the gutter.
But is it going to be a 16,000 polygon tier?
Depends if it's next gen or not. I might go old school.
Okay.
Yep.
Next gen crying versus
all right, so
old school crying.
The other game is a little game called Pokemon White Version 2, which...
Ooh.
Yeah, which was on sale for $15 at Best Buy. Yeah.
Really?
Wow.
And I saw that and that's I was like, really good. You know, I have plenty of games to play. But then the next day I was like, I'm an idiot if I don't pick that game up for $15, even if I don't play it.
And you love Pokemon.
I wouldn't say I love Pokemon. I like Pokemon. I think I want to like Pokemon more than I actually do like Pokemon. But
I can sympathize with that. That's why I'm waiting for X and Y.
Yeah, but that's what I always said. I said, you know, I always say that I'm not going to buy a like whatever Pokemon game happens to be coming out.
And then
but
Carly's
always,
like, but you have to.
I know. I always wind up buying them. So now I'm just, you know, I couldn't
let us have the opportunity for you to stiff us when you're supposed to pick us up in the car to go buy the game.
It's kind of a weird coincidence that you're picking up two deeply emotionally affecting games the same week. I have
cried many a tear in Pokemon. Mostly because I was being electrocuted by that PAX East display 3 years ago.
My Riolu is evolving. I can't handle it. So I do have Pokemon Black. So it was interesting to kind of compare the two. I mean, obviously they're using the same engine. They look very similar. They're set in the same place. So the games are very similar in many ways. Pokemon fans, that won't be a problem. But, you know, I would say probably if you're looking to get one or the other, I would say version 2 is probably the one to go with, because I think, I'd have to go back and check Pokemon Black, but there's a couple of things that I think that they've added that just kind of sort of like, just to make the menus easier to traverse. They also let you pin stuff to the Y button, and you can select things from that.
Like,
so,
literally just pin them to the button on your
absolutely, yep. You
DS.
Actually take out a pin, James. You take out
you
a pin and physically
right
just
in there.
Pull something out of the game and pin it right onto your Y button.
It's kind of like the Jaguar. Like, the games are now coming with stickers, and you take them out and you put them on the buttons on the system to customize them.
That's
for
some
each
old
game.
School Atari action.
It is. It is. But yeah, so you can just kind of set up your menu of sort of your, you know, your kind of bookmark stuff. So, but like, you know, no matter where you are, if you have like, you can kind of check a checkbox if you're in your Pokeball bag, and you can click Y and, you know, go right to your Pokeball bag if you feel like it. So there's stuff like that. I mean, the gameplay is still good. I think Pokemon's like, definitely people, you know, kind of criticize Pokemon for not changing over the years, but that's because I think the core gameplay is really, really solid. And I think overall, my impression of it when I play this game is that it really kind of taps into almost a sort of whimsical, innocent, sort of childlike happiness that most games just don't have nowadays, like even like RPGs or even games that are sort of aimed at children. I find that like, they just kind of lack like a genuine sort of like sort of like happiness about them. Like everything in Pokemon is, hey, you know, you really, you know, don't be a bad person kind of thing. Like,
don't be a bad person. Just enjoy this industrialized cockfighting.
Well, well, it's like, hey, you know, everything is like, hey, take care of your little creatures and make sure that they grow up big and strong and you be a good person and you live your dreams one day. And, you know,
it's very encouraging.
It is. It's very encouraging. You know, it's, and it's funny because I play this game and I'm like, as an adult, I'm like, or barely an adult, but I play it and I'm like, you know,
legally an adult.
Legally an adult. I play it and I'm like, wow, like, you know, I can see why parents like kids playing this game because it does, it just bombards you with, you know, positive reinforcement and positive, you know, messages and stuff.
So I was tempted briefly by the version 2s of Black and White just because I was kind of intrigued by the idea that they were, you know, refining what they'd already done and not remaking Black and White, but kind of saying like, what if we literally use the same engine, but then changed as much as we could? And I heard, you know, the story is like unusually interesting and there were some cool things about it, but ultimately I'm so glad I waited. Cause I, you know, it was around that actually Black and White 2 came out well after 3DS.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And at the time I was like, I think I'm just going to wait and see what they do on 3DS. And when we saw the X and Y footage, I was like, oh, I'm so glad I waited. Because the thing about X and Y, we haven't really talked about it much on the show, but the thing that excites me is that it actually, you know, the graphics are finally colorful and bright and smooth and sort of organic looking enough that it kind of fits the character models that they have. And that's part of the problem I had with all these other Pokemon games on the handhelds. Is the sprite work that they have, I really don't think does much justice to the character designs. Because a lot of the Pokemon character designs are really cool. But the kind of grainy, especially during battles, the like weirdly unnecessarily pixelated, like creepy zoom around.
Because it's the same sprite, just blown up. That's
why. Yeah, like the horrible sound effects, you know, these sort of roars that the Pokemon do that just sound like digitized Game Boy shit.
Yep.
In 2013, that does not cut it, you know. And I feel like X and Y is like, this overhaul of the assets is, to me, it's going to bring the series so much more in, you know, the tone that you talked about, like the whimsical nature of the story and the cute innocence of it. To me, the graphics never really lived up to that. I mean, in 1998 on Black and White Game Boy, fine, you know, but like at some point I felt like the series just really got way beyond what the assets that they had.
Yeah.
And I found it really odd that they were continuing to make assets, you know, for all these new Pokemon and yet in the old style and essentially for backwards compatibility purposes. And like, that's one of the good things about the 3DS game, I'm hoping, is that I kind of hope X and Y are not compatible with any other Pokemon game because I really do want them to start fresh. I mean, we joked one time about like Pokemon Genocide and basically just starting over from zero. But
yeah,
you know, I kind of hope that they do that. I kind of hope that Pikachu is not in the game. I really want them to just start from scratch, be creative, and not be tied down to the conventions that they have been for so long. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why I'm excited about the new ones.
Yeah, I mean it's obviously a conscious effort on their part to keep the series up to this point looking very, very old school. So,
oh yeah.
I mean, even you know the engine in this one has, you know, it's, there's a lot of kind of scaling, artifacting kind of thing on everything, and you know, it has that kind of sort of F-Zero type of look to it. You know, when it, you know, when you go up to the top of a hill and kind of look out over the rest of the world, it's still, you know, it's not a graphical powerhouse, I'll tell you that.
But it's really cool that you picked this up, especially for cheap. So
yeah, I mean, I pretty much couldn't turn it down, and I knew from Pokemon Black. I mean, there's just, I'm not going to use half of the stuff that's in there, but I mean, there's, you can, I mean, you can battle online, you can trade Pokemon online. I think you can, like, I don't know, you can do so much stuff. There's, you know, it's just crazy how much that they've actually. It's very impressive.
Crazy, like there's a lot of like quasi Street Pass stuff too, even though it's a DS game.
Yep. Yeah, you can exchange friend codes, and you can, you know, you have like the surveys. We were doing that at PAX East one year. Where that you can fill out the Pokemon surveys and other people that have it can fill it out for you. I don't know, it's crazy.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how do you feel about Ice Dreamus? 0. I feel 0 about this fucking ice cream cone.
Okay, so moving on to Guillaume.
I have to say that a couple of weeks ago we had a letter from James Charlton, and his enthusiasm for a certain game just was so infectious.
Oh, dude, he loves this game.
I know. So I had to jump on the chance to review Fist of the North Star, Ken's Rage 2.
You lucky goat.
To be honest, I've never watched the series before. I've never, I'm only dimly aware. I think I've seen the live action movie years ago.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, I don't really remember anything about it. But...
A live action movie for Fist of the North Star? That's just crazy.
Is it better than Mortal Kombat?
Oh, it's so much dumber than Mortal Kombat.
Watch it drunk. That's all.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, but just make it a shots game. You'll be drunk by the second scene. You're fine.
But yeah, actually, I had played like the demo for the first game, and I thought it seemed kind of decent. Like, I thought maybe I could get into this. No, but like, I don't know. I guess I was starving for an action game, and I happened to play a demo for that one. I was like, well, this could do the trick, but I ended up never buying it. But now Ken's Rage 2, I had to jump on that, and...
Ken's got so much excess rage.
I've been trying so hard to see the positives and to try to give the game a fair shake. You know, like, because I realized after I accepted the review, I was like, wait, I'm not a fan of Dynasty Warriors.
I was so excited to see you accepted this review.
I'm not a fan of Fist of North Star. The fans will eat me alive if I just, review this and give it a poor score. And it's very apparent that I don't know anything about this game. Or
give it 5 exploding heads out of 10. You'll be good to go.
I tried so hard, and I was like, okay. The action is kind of mindless. It's set in this post-apocalyptic setting where nuclear bombs have gone off, and apparently that distorted the laws of physics, so that really muscular men just appear out of thin air 2 meters from the ground and drop beside you so you can punch them. So that's a very interesting concept that I had never heard of before.
It's high art.
and they just explode at the as soon as you touch them, basically. And I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe it gets better as it goes on. I have to say that even though I don't take the story seriously at all, the people who made the game seem to have really done it they paid it respect. Like the way that the cutscenes unfold are basically, live, what do they call them?
Oh, like motion comics?
Motion comics. So yeah, they're kind of like in-engine motion comics. And I think the effect works pretty well. Like at some point I was watching them and I was like, well, even though this is really not stuff that I'm into, I'm glad that I'm experiencing the story like this, because I'm sure it's a better experience than I would get just watching the anime or reading the manga. But then as it goes on and on, I'm just like, the game is wearing me out. Like, I'm just, the game won't end, and there's cutscenes in the middle of boss fights. Like, sometimes, like, it will stop twice. I'm like, holy shit, this is as wordy, as intrusive as a Metal Gear Solid game, and it has much less to say. How is that possible? What's going on here?
But it has way more head explosions.
And there's a lot of cutscenes or just, bullshit posturing from minor characters that don't even have a name, and you're just like, he goes through the whole you're already dead thing, and always the same, like, it's very repetitive, and I'm just like, wow, they really put the integrality of the manga on there. And that's probably a bad idea, because most of it is not very interesting.
It's very much true to Monster of the Week-ism, that sort of plague series like that, where basically it's every week it's just next man up. I mean, you think at some point people go like, dude, this Ken guy punches you and your head blows the fuck up. We should probably stay away from him.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's very convenient that, the one guy who happens to be able to make people die by touching them is a good guy. I don't know. I'm glad that he's around, I guess. But yeah, like, the story is not really, the first chapter ends an important part of his story. But then you go on and he's just like, he enters this village and the village is plagued by this band of assholes. And he takes care of the assholes, and then he's off to another village where he's going to take care of another band of assholes.
That's Tom Hanks' next movie.
But I've just now, gotten back to a point where there seems to be, some characters that are actually tied to his backstory. So it's still not very interesting, but it's definitely more interesting than what I've seen so far. The game doesn't really teach you how to play it correctly. Like the main story mode is a cakewalk, and I'm just doing the same combo over and over again, and I'm doing fine. But then there's like these dream modes. It's a secondary mode where you can play as other characters, and they're kind of what if scenarios, or they flesh out some of the side characters. And this mode has, you know, at the point I'm at, I'm actually facing, Kenjiro, the main character, and I cannot beat him. And, you know, some helpful fans gave me tips about how to, you know, like, okay, well, this attack breaks this block, and, you know, do this if that happens. But this game has broken me. I don't want to be playing it anymore.
Awesome.
Well, then don't. You don't have to finish it to review it.
Yeah, I know. Some people love these games, and I'm just, you know, I wanted to make sure to give it a fair shake.
I think you can love this game for being just dumb as hell and possibly be okay with it. But I think that's really the limit.
I've known people who are into Dynasty Warriors, and they like it because they jump in there and they kill dudes and then they turn it off. It's like, if you only have 15 minutes a day to play a video game and you don't care about a story or progression or accomplishing anything, you just want that visceral response of I'm pressing buttons and dudes are dying all over the place.
Oh yeah.
It gives you that, and it gives it to you in a very dense way, so you don't need to play it for hours at a time. If you play that game for 15 minutes, you will kill hundreds of people.
Oh yeah.
And if that's all you want, then you can do that and then turn it off and then move on with your life. And so, and because it's stupid, you can kind of just come back to it over and over again. And it's like a weird comfort food for people. In all seriousness, I've seen people who have this addiction, and it's really weird, but I kind of get it.
Yeah, and that's one of the problems. Like, I'm playing it for review. I'm already late. I'm already dead also, but I'm already late for it. But, you know, like, I'm still forcing the playthrough.
Nobody's beating down the walls to get to your review.
Yeah, I know. but it's not ideal. Like, I do think that if you're only playing this in 15 minutes bursts, then you don't get worn out as much by the mindless action and the stupid cutscenes that they interrupt the gameplay every 2 minutes. It's super annoying.
Yeah. Okay, so what else you been playing, Guillaume?
Well, for the past month, I guess, I've been quietly whittling away at Dragon Quest VI, and it's a game I've owned since it was released. And back then, I had been looking forward to it very much, because I'm a very, very, very big fan of Dragon Quest V. I think that a lot of that is due to Jeremy Parrish writing so much about it, and just, you know, like, he had psyched me up for that game so much, and then I was playing it, I was like, wow, top three RPGs ever. Like, this is amazing. This is up there with Chrono Trigger.
Well, Parrish loves Five because of the story. I can't really appreciate the story the way he does. I don't really get it. I don't really see why the story is so great.
I really enjoyed the storytelling of Dragon Quest V, but I also appreciated the fact that it's probably more of a guided experience than most Dragon Quest games. Like, you kind of can see the rails a little bit, you know, like you're herded off always in the right direction.
Well, in contrast.
Yeah, Dragon Quest VI, it starts out very much that way, actually. Like, for the first 10 hours, you're pretty much on the one path that will lead you to the one confrontation against the monster that at first you believe is, you know, the last boss of the game. So it plays very much like Dragon Quest V. And what happened when I beat that boss and I realized, oh, wait, so I'm not nearly done. Like, there's still a lot of the map to explore. And, like, these guys are celebrating the defeat of the boss that I just killed. But, you know, obviously there was more to this game. But what happened is that I just stopped playing. I was like, you know what? I'm not sure if I want to keep playing this. Like, I'm not sure if it's exactly what I want to be playing right now. And, I just stopped. And it was kind of a weird satisfying point where I felt like, okay, I've accomplished my goal here, and it doesn't really matter if there's a loose thread here and there. Like, I just didn't care.
See, I would say that's where the game really kind of starts.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, I don't know if you remember, but at that point in the game, that's where it looks like they really stop directing you exactly where to go.
Yeah.
And I think that the sudden freedom kind of, you know, annoyed me a little bit. Like, because in a JRPG, freedom often means, quote unquote, exploring just to find the next point that you're supposed to find. Like, it's not so much exploring as it is finding where you're supposed to go without really much indication. And it's not really something that I enjoy. Like, I do enjoy being let loose in a world like in Fallout 3, where there's always something to see, and probably some side quests to do. But in Dragon Quest, it's pretty much, you know, okay, off you go, try to find the next town that you're supposed to be in, and to talk to the right person.
See, I found the Tales of the Abyss was very much like that, especially because they would tell you to go to some town that you've never been to, and they don't even tell you where it is. Where in Dragon Quest, I feel like, yeah, there in six, I should say, in Dragon Quest six, that I feel like there are moments where you're not really sure what to do next, but that's because they've given you a boat or a dragon to fly around on or something like that, and suddenly you have so many places that you can go. And yes, one of them will advance the story, but several of them will give you things to do and things to see. And there are side quests, and there are, you know, just a lot of towns where you can go and upgrade your equipment and go look for magic and stuff like that, and kind of understand how these different, because you have more than one overworld, and you can kind of learn how they connect together and how to get to certain places. And I mean, I love that kind of stuff, but that's also one of my favorite things about RPGs. So, I can understand if you're in it for the story, which I think is a little bit crazy in Dragon Quest, because the stories are never all that great. But if you're in it for the story, then I can see how that would be disappointing.
Thanks for saying I'm crazy. No, but seriously, like, I just
psychotic bastard.
You know, I can see your point, but at the same time, I don't think that exploration in Dragon Quest games is all that rewarding. Like, you say, okay, you can go to certain towns and upgrade your equipment, but I find very much in this game that wherever you go, it's going to be too pricey and you're going to have to grind, or you happen to be, you know, in the correct sequence, you go to the correct town where things are affordable, and there you can actually upgrade your equipment. Like, I don't like this sort of fake open worldliness to it. Like, it's very much like you're supposed to tackle things in a certain order, and if you don't, you're making things difficult for yourself for no good reason.
That's fair. That is totally fair.
So I'm about 25 hours into the game now. I actually started over because I wanted to... Well, I didn't remember exactly what I had been doing like 2-3 years ago. So I started over, and now I'm 25 hours into the game, and I'm enjoying it more. But only now do I, you know, have I reached a point in the story where it kind of fleshes out the backstory of your character. And yeah, like in this game, I don't think that the narrative is as strong as it was in Dragon Quest V. Yeah. But, you know, like, I'm just, you know, chipping away at the game like 20 minutes and during my commute, or, you know, taking a break at work, and it's working out well so far. But I just, you know, sometimes I go rely on a guide or something because I have no idea where I'm supposed to go. And the game is not very good at telling you, you know, what's the next step. There's several resources that you can use, like you can press B and talk to your party members, but they're often not all that useful. Well, there's this seer that you can talk to, but she often misleads you. Like, she often tells me, oh, go to this castle, that's where you're supposed to go. And I go there, and it turns out that I'm like one step ahead. There's something else I'm supposed to do before that. So that, you know, like, thank you. That was absolutely useless.
Yeah.
Well, on the bright side, on the next turn, you'll know what you need to do.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
She's too good at her job.
She is seeing way the hell in the future.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to get through the game, and I'm eager at this point to move on to something else. Because the, you know, the Dragon Quest combat is not all that interesting, and there's a lot of it in this game, and I'm only tolerating it because, you know, like, I'm only playing in, like, 15-minute bursts. Yeah. I
oh,
guess...
God, that game will take an eon to finish.
I think I played it for about 50 or 60 hours. I can't really argue with the things you're saying, and that's why a lot of people don't like Dragon Quest, you know, because they don't like what it does. But I guess I'm just surprised that that people like 5 more than other games in the series, because at this point I've played every Dragon Quest except 7, and I'm hoping that 3DS remake that's out in Japan now is going to come over so I can do that one too. But I think they're very consistent in terms of the storytelling and the world design and the amount of grinding that you have to do and the kind of sequential economy like you talked about, where, you know, every shop is overpriced except the one that you that you're kind of leveled up to. Mm-hmm. And at least until 8, I think there's a few things start to shift in 8, but that's also, you know, that was a new developer. It was the first kind of really 3D game. And it had been several years since 7. And so it was a really kind of big leap, and it looked faithful, but under the hood, I think they had done a lot to kind of streamline it a little bit. Mm-hmm. But certainly the first 6 games are very consistent, I think. And I guess I'm always surprised when I hear that people really love this or that Dragon Quest game and they don't really like the other ones. Cause I think it's kind of like people who love this one Pokemon and they don't like all the other Pokemons. I'm like, you know, they're all the same, right?
Exactly.
I really disagree though. I do think that 5 plays to certain strengths that, you know, 6 doesn't have the same focus, I would say. And I think at this point it had also passed to in the hands of another developer, hadn't it? Like, I don't think that 5 and 6 were developed by the same team.
I thought all 3 of those Super Famicom games were, but I don't know.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that 6 is one of the more sprawling non-linear games in the entire series.
Yeah.
That is probably its key defining characteristic, is that it has 3 overworlds, and mm-hmm. they love to let you loose in that overworld and kind of let you figure out where to go next. And that's one thing I liked about it, and I understand why you don't.
Yeah, like every 5 steps you get stopped in that exploration, and the skills that you have to keep monsters at bay don't work. They never have in any Dragon Quest ever.
True.
Fuck you.
True.
developers. But yeah, I'm still, don't get me wrong, I'm still enjoying it on some level because I'm still playing it. I wouldn't, trust me, like I know when to quit a game when I'm really not enjoying it. And there's something very comforting about, you know, the mindlessness of the combat, or, you know, just exploring. There is something fun in that, but it's not doing it for me the way that Dragon Quest V did.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'll go next with new business. My stuff shouldn't take too long, but I start out with, I checked out Wii Street U, which is a horrible, horrible name. For
it is
anything.
The worst name.
and I guess I can't blame them because, you know, they're stuck with the Wii U name, which is horrible in the first place. It's kind of doubly horrible. It's like
maybe
bad on top of bad. And now with Wii Street U, they've tripled the badness of the
Wii Street
convention.
U in the face.
Maybe, maybe Walking Simulator was already taken.
Well, I downloaded this because it was free, you
right.
know, and I figured I would spend 2 seconds with it. I ended up spending about 10 or 15 minutes with it, which is way more than I expected. And I guess I was a little confused about just what this thing is, because I guess I'd never watched the Nintendo Direct where they actually kind of, you know, walked through it and showed exactly what it does. But I was getting this confused with the panorama view that they're still working on, I think. And the panoramic view is like where they show these like live action videos where they've actually shot video, but they've done it in this weird 360 degree camera. And it's kind of like that E3 demo from a couple years ago when they first showed the system.
Uh-huh.
And they've talked about releasing that, but it's only going to have, you know, 4 or 5 different videos, and then you can pay for extra ones. And so I was expecting this to be like a very limited experience and just kind of a weird kind of, you know, I'll sample it and then I'll probably delete it and never think about it again. And somewhere along the way, I had kind of lost track of the fact that Wii Street U is actually a fully functioning version of Google Maps.
It is, yes.
So anything on the planet Earth that Google has shot their street view of, which is almost any road you could possibly think of, is in this app. So you have access to the entire global network of Google Maps. And it's free, and I don't think it's monetized at all. I don't think there's any future DLC for this or anything like that. It's very self-contained. And so, at first, you know, you open it up and you're on like the streets of Shibuya or something like that. And then you can like push a button and it opens up a menu and it has all these recommendations and it has all these, you know, famous locations around the world where you can jump to. And walk around, like I went inside the White House, which is very confusing because Street View is made for streets. And so when you put it inside this building, the whole, like the way they draw lines out in 3D space and have you walk along them gets really confusing. It's kind of like playing Killer 7, except there's about three times as many paths that you can choose.
And about one third as much blood.
Yeah. But like you say, it's confusing, but it is an awesome shortcut when you're in Washington, D.C. Just cut right through the White House.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're on Pennsylvania, you know, you need to get to the other side. So there are some locations that they recommend, and I'm not really sure that the technology makes any damn sense, you know, for those locations. Cause I thought, I'd like to see the inside of the White House. That sounds really interesting. And I go in there, and it's just like the resolution of the camera and the weird routes that they have mapped through the building just don't make any sense. And it's very, very confusing and hard to use.
Is it kind of like those, flash player, you know, old museum tours, virtual museum tours?
Yeah. Yeah. I could see that. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's how it feels when you're in an internal location like that. But when you're out on the street, it's Google Street View. And I think most people have messed around with it at some point. And as you have probably done on Google's website, you can totally like type in your own home address and go there. And it's kind of freaky to look around and see, oh, wow, someone actually took photos of the outside of my house or the place where I work or something like that.
I'm used to it.
But it's kind of neat, but you know, on the computer, the problem is that you're basically clicking on all these different buttons to kind of shove, like you can rotate the camera like 10 degrees at a time, you know, around the sphere. And it's very kind of jerky and it just doesn't, it's not a very good experience. Like it's really cool. It's not very useful. I don't think it ever was useful. But the great thing about the Wii U version is that you literally, I mean, it's all motion control. So you just move the gamepad around in space and the camera moves very smoothly around this whole view that they've done. And it gives it a completely different feel from using Google Maps on the computer. It's good. I mean, and I know this is kind of, it sounds like Iwata, you know, when he's talking about, we think moving the gamepad in space will make you feel like you're really there. The creepy thing is it kind of does.
It does. It's and weird.
I made the kind of just random decision to type in the address of the street where I grew up. And this is a place I haven't really been in probably 10 years. But of course it's, you know, I know what this neighborhood looks like very, very, very well. And I put in this address thinking it's probably not even in here, you know, and of course it found it. And all of a sudden I'm looking at my driveway of the house I grew up in and it like induced weird emotions in me that I was not expecting. And I start marching down the street. You know, you kind of do it one little increment at a time and it pushes you forward like 20 feet every time you push the button. But every time you move forward and stop, you can look around in fully 360 degrees in a very natural way. And it really does kind of mimic some of the views that I had riding my bike down these streets and looking at the houses on either side of the road and seeing, oh, wow, that tree is still there. And it was really kind of freaky in a good way. Like it actually left me feeling kind of good and nostalgic inside. And I was like, this is just a personal experience that I was not expecting when I turned on this stupid free app on Wii U. So I don't have much else to say about it. I mean, again, it's really gimmicky and it certainly has almost no practical value whatsoever. But if you haven't checked out Wii Street U yet, I really would recommend opening up and trying a few things. And, you know, you can go to some of the famous locations that they have there. But I think if you go to a place you've actually been and that you actually have, you know, strong memories of.
It's way creepier.
It is a very different experience than, you know, walking around the streets of Tokyo where you've never been and just seeing all those people in the neon signs and stuff.
Yeah.
It's a neat thing. And, you know, it may be a long time before I ever turn this thing back on because I don't really care. You know, it's just, it's like something that it now lives on my system and I'll never use it again, like Everybody Votes channel. But I can imagine, like, my sister comes to visit in a couple of months and she's never played Wii U. And if I'm going to turn it on and show her something really crazy that she's never seen before, I am totally going to use this because it's going to blow her mind, because it's just a really bizarre experience to kind of look around a place that you know and see it in this weird, like, virtual reality version. So, yeah,
and know that anybody else on the planet can see it exactly as you see it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
You kind of think like when you're not there, it's almost like the place doesn't exist, like to you or anybody else. You know what I mean?
John closes his eyes and thinks nobody can see him.
Yeah. It's just weird.
I know what you mean. No, there's a weird kind of voyeurism to it, but also it's like a weird trip down memory lane, almost literally down memory lane, you know, walking down the streets where I grew up. It's a really neat experience. So I would recommend checking it out. Also this week, I got a Wii U hard drive. I mean, I got a hard drive and connected it to my Wii U.
Well, you should have plenty of space then for the 12 gigs it takes for Ken's Rage 2.
Yeah, that's a problem
Ken's
I'm never going to have.
Steroid-fueled rage.
But the storage was starting to become a problem because, you know, one of the first games I downloaded was Assassin's Creed 3, which it takes up a ridiculous 17 gigabytes, which is literally more than 10 times as big as New Super Mario Bros. U. And between those two games alone, I pretty much didn't have room for anything else. And so by the time something came out like The Cave or, you know, the demo for Zombie U or something like that, I couldn't even download that stuff until I deleted something. So I ended up deleting Assassin's Creed, which I hated to do because I wanted to keep playing it. But it was so fucking huge on my, you know, internal system memory that I basically couldn't get anything new for the system until I deleted it. So I deleted that knowing that, you know, one day I would get a hard drive and re-download it. Well, I got a hard drive. 2 days later, I'm still downloading it because it takes forever. Because the Nintendo Network is the slowest piece of shit I've ever seen. But the good news is the actual hard drive functionality is really nice. So I got one of the hard drives that was listed on Nintendo's website for, you know, having been tested and being confirmed to be compatible with Wii U. And I have no idea what makes some hard drives not compatible and some are, because I had an old USB 2.0 hard drive that I've had for 3 or 4 years and had it connected to my desktop, but I didn't really need it because my desktop has a huge hard drive now. And so I moved everything off this hard drive, put it on the desktop, and figured I'll just use this. And I went over there and plugged it in, and the Wii U basically just didn't recognize it.
Mm. Was it a powered, like, was it plugged in a wall?
No, it's not powered. It's USB 2.0, and I guess it's a slower drive speed, and it's made to run off USB power.
It will recognize, I think, USB 2.0 hard drives that are powered, that you plug in a wall outlet. But otherwise, you need a 3.0 and you need a Y cable.
The Y cable is a way to get around plugging into the wall. But the one that I bought that Nintendo recommended, among several others, is a 3.0 hard drive, and it also has a wall adapter. I looked around. I don't think any hard drive comes with a Y adapter. I think that's just an accessory that you have to go to Radio Shack or, you know, whatever.
I ordered mine off the internet. It took a couple of weeks to get here, but it was cheap. It was like $3.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, Newegg has them. But you need to know what shape the USB jack on your hard drive is before you order it. Mm-hmm. So I would not recommend trying to purchase a hard drive and a Y cable separately from the internet at the same time, because there are a lot of different kinds of Y cables. Anyway, I might eventually get a Y cable, but I really don't care. I mean, I have enough wall outlets that I can plug the thing in. And that seems to work fine. So I got myself a terabyte hard drive for my Wii U.
Nice.
Already full, I'm sure.
You could download so many copies of Ken's Rage.
Defiantly getting a terabyte. I will add
That's
that.
That's right.
Defiantly.
A terabyte. There we go.
Terabyte. this is your response to all the Wii U haters, I think. That's right, on Twitter, Johnny. That's
right. Suck it. I'm buying a hard drive because I want to download, you know, all the new, especially the first party stuff that I know will come out on the same day on eShop, mm-hmm. and I get my 10% back. And the prices on those games are probably not ever going down in the retail space. So I've got nothing to lose by just downloading it, you know, in terms of price comparison and everything to gain. So I have always intended to download most of my Wii U games. That's been the plan from before the system even came out. So the hard drive is a good investment, I think. You know, I paid like $60 for it, and it will never fill up, ever.
It's not bad at all. Mm-hmm. $60 for that much storage space?
Yeah.
Yeah. The only caveat is that you have to format it for the Wii U, and then you can't use it on your PC at all.
That's true. Yeah, it is an exclusive Wii U hard drive now.
Yeah, you can't partition it either. I tried, and it just, you know, as soon as you plug it in the Wii U, it just destroys the partition if you say, yes, I want to format this hard drive.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would say that if you're not willing to make it an exclusive Wii U hard drive, you're just a hater, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you're not all in, so just you deal with that in your own time,
I'm starting to doubt your commitment to Sparkle Motion. the good thing is, even though Wii U only has USB 2.0 ports, which is stupid because 3.0 has been out for a while and it's not expensive, so it's really, really, you know, stupid that Nintendo didn't pay 50 cents extra to use USB 3.0. I found that moving stuff over to it was very, very fast. It's a hell of a lot faster than downloading it in the first place. That's for sure. So I had everything moved over within 10 minutes. You know, it was no big deal at all. And then once you do that, the eShop has an automatic setting. I think you can change this, but by default, if you have a USB hard drive plugged in, the eShop will automatically download everything that you buy directly to the hard drive. You don't have to set it. It's not like, you know, on the Wii Shop channel, you always have to tell it system memory or SD card, system memory or SD card. And it's an important choice because on the Wii, there's a very significant difference in access speed between those two. So you don't want to put something you're going to play every day on the SD card because it takes too long to load it up. That's more kind of your museum where you go and get stuff that you hardly ever play. And if there's something you're going to use often, you'd like that to be on the system memory. In this case, the transfer speed is so fast to the hard drive that you really can't even tell the difference. So everything things on the Wii U load up pretty slow universally.
That's right. They just lowered the bar.
But it certainly doesn't feel any slower when you load it from the hard drive than it does from the system memory. So I'm very happy with it so far. I'm surprised. It's a very seamless, very easy to set up experience if you get the right hard drive. One thing that I moved over and went ahead and kind of played more of and kind of finished was The Cave.
An 8.5 game if I've ever played one, that's for sure.
Okay. You know, I respect your opinion, and I know that people...
But it's wrong.
I know that... No, I'm not... That's something you say, James. I don't say that. I can't say that I enjoyed The Cave a whole lot, and I'm disappointed by that because I was looking forward to it. I mean, I paid $15 of real US dollars for this game.
Sega thanks you.
And I put, you know, 4 or 5 hours into it, and I didn't enjoy it that much. I was excited by the concept, and there are things I like about it a lot. I like the art style. I think the voice acting is pretty good. And, you know, some of the puzzles are neat and some of the writing is clever, but overall, I just feel like I didn't really get much out of it. And unfortunately, you know, I mean, it is kind of trying to supposedly streamline the adventure game, you know, the old kind of computer style adventure game format. I think this game is at least as tedious as a point and click adventure game on PC. I mean, I think Monkey Island is probably easier to play than this. It certainly doesn't take as long to get from one place to the other. Cause by giving you direct control over the characters, you're now required to actually move those characters everywhere they go. And the cave is a pretty big place. And sometimes the distances from one place or another are so long and it requires so much walking that I wonder if they're just padding it out so they have time to load up the next area into the memory. Because it doesn't make any sense. I mean, there are these long tunnels that you walk through where there's nothing there. There's nothing to look at. There's nothing to do. It's just a place you have to walk through. And unfortunately, in a lot of cases, they make you do it 3 times because you have these 3 characters who are controlled totally independently. And every now and then they give you a puzzle where it's really cool that you have three characters because they're all doing different things and they're working together. But in a lot of cases, having the three characters, it really doesn't make any difference. You know, I mean, all they've done is they've put three switches around the cave in these various locations, and you have to manually move each character to one of those switches and then pull them all at the same time. And they could have accomplished exactly the same thing by just putting it on one switch and saving you about 5 minutes of bullshit walking around.
So it's just walk around and hit switches.
That's the game. The entire game is walk around
and hit
switches.
So you're telling me they made the new Adventures of Mary-Kate and Ashley?
Ugh, I don't...
That's
I
what they
know,
have made.
But it's sad because, I mean, there are a handful of puzzles in the game that are actually really clever and make sense with the characters, and they make sense with the you know, the setting of the cave and what's going on there. And there are some puzzles that I thought were neat. You know, they involve using special items, and the items have their own kind of descriptions, and they're very idiosyncratic, and you think, what the hell am I going to do with this thing? Mm-hmm. And then when you figure it out, it's like, oh, that's really cool. I mean, that's the feeling that you got from those old point-and-click adventure games, the really good ones. You know, it's like using – you have this inventory full of random bullshit, and then when you finally figure out this weird combination of things that you can use, all of a sudden this light bulb lights up, and you think, well, I'm not even sure that's logical, but at least it's funny that you would use those two things together to solve this puzzle. And the cave has a couple of instances like that. But most of it is not very inventive at all and not very funny. And that's a big problem that I have with this game, is that it's clearly trying to be clever and funny, but I don't think this is actually funny at all. I didn't think the writing was all that great. The voice acting's okay, but I don't think there's only one voice in the entire game. You've got seven characters and they're all mute, which is a terrible decision. So the only person you ever hear from audibly is the cave itself. And unfortunately, although he's an okay as a character, I mean, he's kind of snarky and he's very condescending towards these adventurers that you're moving through the cave. Mm-hmm. But sometimes you can play for 20 minutes and not hear a peep from him. He doesn't actually talk that often. He mostly talks in between sections of the game. There's only like five or six sections. So you can play for a long time and hear nothing from him, which means the game is virtually silent.
Like
it's
John.
Really weird. There's not even that much music. It's really, the audio design is just bizarre.
But I can see your complaints. I personally, I don't know. I think it's a case of, I like platformers so much that I, you know, even though it's not good platforming, even though these characters are not Mario, I was, you know, sufficiently entertained by just jumping around and trying to catch like a rope to climb like at the optimum height or something. You know, I was kind of making my own fun that way. I realize that's not for everyone. But also like perhaps like people who have had like a lot of quote unquote, like LucasArts adventure game training, will perhaps have to do a little bit less, going, you know, back and forth, and, therefore, like, minimize the amount of just tedious traveling that perhaps other people would have to do.
Well, I accept your dig at my adventure game skills, but I've played a lot of adventure games.
I'm just saying I'm really good at them.
Okay, sure. And I take you on your word for that. It's not a skill that's very easy to demonstrate for others, but, you know, I played the old King's Quest games on computer and LucasArts games too. A lot of times in those games, the solution to the puzzle is on the same screen as the puzzle. So, because those games, I mean, the walking around is not even really a mechanic. You just point and the dude goes there. It's a means to an end. The end is solving the puzzle. So they don't make you walk around a ton to solve the puzzles because there's no point to it. That's not fun. The fun is thinking about it. The fun is observing these things and hearing the dialogue or reading the text and putting things together and solving these puzzles. And so they typically will, you know, put all these things in a relatively confined space because they want to put you in the room with the key and it's right in front of your face and it just takes you a while to figure that out, right? And then that's how you have that aha moment. But in the cave, a lot of the puzzles are take this thing, truck it way over there where you're going to use it, Except you get over there and you find out, oh, that's not the right thing I was supposed to take over there. So now you need to bring it all the way back to where you got it and then take a different thing over there with a different character. It's just tedious. I mean, my problem with The Cave is not that it's a bad platformer, although it is a bad platformer. I think conceptually the idea of doing an adventure game like this in the guise of a platformer is great. You know, giving you that immediate control over the characters, I think is a really good idea, and it's a good way to bring that genre to a console experience. Yeah, it's not a good platformer. I could look over that. I don't think it's a very good adventure game. That's my problem with it. I don't think the writing and the story and the puzzles are very good. So anyway, I finished it. I'm not going to go play it with more characters. I've had enough. I was just kind of pushing myself through the end of it I just want to move on from this, you know? It's too bad. I mean, I really was interested in the game. Clearly, people like it, but I just can't recommend it.
The puzzles and the writing did it for me. Like, it's just, I guess, what I grew up with, like these games. But also, you know, like I tried to minimize for the most part the back and forth by having each character carry one thing, and then I would go off and actually explore. Maybe not the entirety of a given level, but, you know, like I would try to see as much as I could and kind of solve puzzles in my head as I go and, you know, take notes and then actually, you know, execute them.
I did the same thing. I think we had the same experience, but we perceived it and we appreciated it differently. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Sorry, I went on longer than I meant to. James, please wrap up new business.
Sure. So, I finished off Fire Emblem Awakening this week, Tuesday, I guess, clocking in somewhere in the low 40s in terms of hours played. That doesn't count in restart time, which thankfully is significantly less because I instituted significantly less draconian restart policies in the classic mode.
Nice.
Most of the time lost in playing it with this casual mode on was the side story chapters where you gain access to extra characters. One of the ones that is particularly nasty is some of them are just normal extra characters. Some of them are children of the married couples you've pushed out on the battlefield. And as couples get married, the paralog for that child will appear on the map so you can go do it. A lot of them are like as hard as the very end of the game, which seems ridiculous when they show up. But there's one in particular where she just runs right into battle like 20 levels too weak for it and just gets her shit wrecked. And like, restart.
Is her name Ruby Weapon?
No, but it's the worst. So basically, in that one instance, I had to read online how somebody did it. They used an item called the Rescue Staff, which lets you pull a character back from the front of the battlefield. And I just kept pulling her back to the starting point the entire battle, just constantly yanking her back. And then once I ran out of uses of that staff, I had cleared almost everything, so she's just running through empty hallways. I'm like, fine. That's what you get. I don't want to deal with you anymore. Stupid.
She's like a toddler on a leash.
Pretty much. She'd get like 10 spaces away from me. I'm like, nope, come on back. Dude, you would think at some point she'd have been like, guys, come on. Nope.
See,
nope.
If the enemy actually had real AI, they would have gone back and basically camped out at the starting point and just ambushed her once everybody else was up on the front lines.
Well, there was one person there who had to yank her back. That would have had to run intercept. I was actually briefly worried they were going to come out. Because there's a split. I was briefly worried they were going to advance on me. I'm like, oh, shit. I don't think I have enough people to hold them back. But, so I cleared through the game. I found it that late in the game, that what they do is the kids, as they are, they have a really high growth rate, so they can catch up with the, you know, the parents, who are, you know, well deep into their second class at this point. And they grow really exponentially faster and end up just dominating the entire front lines of the very last end stages of the game. So there's this awesome feeling of, well, I just replaced everybody. That sucks. But, you know, I really enjoyed this game. You know, I said when I played the demo that I had a feeling it's going to be the best Fire Emblem I've ever played. And I feel like it lived up to that. It's productional its production values are so much more intense than any of the previous games. I really enjoyed it.
Intense production values?
Intense.
Okay.
It's intense. They come at you from all sides. It's really just like that all the time.
Oh, I see.
I do really think, though, they did a really good job with this game, and I really hope there's another one relatively soon in behind it. What I've been doing now is playing with you get a certain amount of free content that unlocks over time, you know, just through Spot Pass. And you gain access to battles with historical characters from the Fire Emblem series, some of which have really fucking powerful armies backing them up. You gain access to a couple situation battles where you get to recruit characters from the story who you either thought you killed or vanished early on that are really, really powerful. You also get, you know, some really nice items, and there's actually a street pass mode where you can street pass teams with other people. The downside of that is because you're still fighting computer AI, you should win, assuming your levels are roughly comparable. So it's not going to be a pure test of how good of a team did you build versus how good of a team did they build. Winning those battles lets you recruit either the leader of this army, which is a historical Fire Emblem character, or the leader of the team you spot passed, which is another, almost certainly another fully classed up tactician, which means it's way the hell too powerful. Which is, fun fact, convert all your characters to tacticians and you will never lose a battle because they are way the hell too powerful. But
then you're never going to get like these conversations, right?
No, you still will. You still get really? Support conversations. Yeah, it's not driven by what class they are. It's just driven by who they are. So I really enjoyed some of the late conversations between the parents and kids because a lot of the kids are really terminally effed up individuals. Like, they're just out there. They are so insane. It's kind of bizarre. I mean, granted, they come from a post-apocalyptic world where all their parents ran off to fight a war, and suddenly they were all made orphans together.
They're military latchkey kids.
Yeah, except they lost all their parents at one time. They're latchkey kids with, like, the worst scenario possible. Oh, also, there's a big giant dragon wiping out humanity. That's kind of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, they come back, and they're, like, they're either, like, really mad at these parents who haven't conceived them yet for vanishing, or just, like, super emotionally screwed up. So you get these really hilariously bizarre conversations where, you know, one character's just... So Lyssa's... to discuss the children a little bit, a lot of the characters, the child is determined by the mother, and it's sort of accented by the father, like hair color and stuff. But, and the stats are sort of an accumulation of the two. So Lyssa's child is this swordsman who just screams about, "His hand burns with fury!" Which is the most, it sounds really awful, but they play it for laughs so much that it's actually really enjoyable to get his support conversations because everybody's just like, "Okay, that's great, I'm gonna go over here." And he just runs around screaming it. It's just, these characters are, you know, you don't see them very much. Like, you see them from the overhead. You control them in battle. You move them around. But there's real payoff. And after you've, you know, used them in battle, getting to see the support conversations between them. I really enjoyed seeing him and Crom's child, his cousins, you know, have these conversations where they're just like, "Okay, I'm gonna go over here. And you can stop that." Or you'll have characters who get like really worried because like, "Oh my god, his hand has a dark power. That's terrifying. What's wrong?" And then they realize he's just full of it. And they're like, "Oh, okay, great. Bye. I'll see you later. I'm gonna go over there."
He's just bullshitting.
No, he's just crazy. He thinks his hand has a dark power. It doesn't. He's just insane.
He's the crazy burning hand guy.
He's like, "My hand holds a dark power." And they're like, like, he's trying to convince his mother she needs to name her weapons because it gives them power. And she's like, "It's a staff. It doesn't do anything." And she's just like, "No, it needs a name so it has a soul." And she's like, "Okay, I'm going to name it Staff." And then he loses his mind. He's like, "No, you can't call it Staff. It'll lose its power."
Charlene.
It's just...
Charlene.
So, in case you never see that, she ends up naming the staff after him, and that freaks him out even more. So it's great.
Awesome.
The all these little things just add to the desire to keep playing the game. I mean, I had avoided the end game, just finishing up these quests and playing the random enemies that spawn just to develop characters that I really had no desire to use. I just wanted to see, I wanted to see their support conversations. I wanted to get a feel for what they felt like in battle. I wanted to play with the class system some more. And I ended up with basically enough characters to run the last stage of the game with two separate parties and still win handily. So, yeah, it's really cool. I'm kind of bummed out, though, that the DLC content, which I actually went and bought. I bought both the packs that are out there, although one of them hasn't fully released yet. One of them is really cool. You get to fight these characters from Fire Emblem history. One of them is basically like the I want to win right now mode, where the zombies stole all the money and you kill them and get lots and lots of cash. And all the characters marvel at how much money they have. One of them is a bunch of experience you gain at one time, and I don't know what the last one is. I think it's like they items. Gain support. Oh, it's items? Okay,
I think it's special weapons, yeah.
Yeah, there's a third pack out in Japan that is, let's call it conducive to support conversations. They are put in unusual scenarios, including the hot spring, which is the Japanest thing ever. But I really enjoy it. I'm kind of bummed to have to wait for the DLC and for the special event battles to get dropped onto my 3DS. I wish I could just get them right now so I could go. Because at this point, any character I recruit, I'm not really going to use. I've beaten the freaking game. I'm gonna go level up Ike so I can bring him into the last battle just for the fun of it. I don't know. It is really fun though, and I'm really happy this game came out and is as good as it is, and I'm really looking forward for them making another one, because at this point they pretty much have to. Nintendo made, what was it, 1.2 million in Japan in like the first month on DLC for this game.
Yeah, but I think Intelligent Systems will probably make it Advance Wars next. It's been at least 4 years since the last Advance Wars.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised if there's an Advance Wars next, but I feel like there'd be at least one more of these in the 3DS's lifespan.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's been a huge success.
Yeah.
I mean, especially in Japan. I think America, you know, and Europe remain to be seen, but...
Well, it's not out in Europe yet.
And that's the thing. It's gotten a lot of good press, though. I mean, really.
It has. Like, it's gotten really ridiculous reviews.
Yeah, I mean, I expected it to pretty much come on the scene and the reaction to be like, oh, well, you know, it's a cool game if you like Fire Emblem games, like pretty much every other Fire Emblem game that's ever been released here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's not that physically different from Fire Emblem. Really, a lot of the changes are presentational. And they ended up to be really, really good tweaks. I'm very happy with the game.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that once I get around to getting it, like, it will be because of casual mode. It makes a whole lot of difference, because I've never finished one, and this will probably be the first one.
Yeah, I'm kind of stuck. Not that I couldn't get past the battle that I'm on, but I've died a few times, and it's doing that Fire Emblem thing where I just get kind of frustrated with it, and I've stopped playing it. And at this point, I haven't played it in a week, and I was really enjoying it up to that point. I just hit one of those walls, you know.
How far are you in?
I don't want to say, because you'll laugh at me, because I'm just really bad at Fire Emblem.
I'm not gonna laugh.
In general. I'm in the arena.
You're in the arena? Okay. It's the arena's a difficult battle. It really is. It's open.
It's fucking
and
me up.
It's a very open battle against very strong opponents.
Yeah.
Well,
that makes me feel better. Thank you. But. I'm very close to either, if I can just switch to casual, I think I'm going to do that. Otherwise, I'm early enough that I might just start over in casual mode.
I think restarting and playing in casual mode, you lose, what, a few hours probably?
Yeah, is it possible to just flip it?
I don't
know. Is it just a setting that you can just change in the menu? Because I'd rather not start over, you know.
I don't think so. Maybe. You certainly can't go casual mode to non-casual mode, and I can see that.
Sure, yeah, that's fair.
But it may be.
I would kind of like the I give up option, you know.
Let me play as a casual
mode. Switch to casual. So anyway, I will be playing it more, but yeah, I'm kind of leaning towards, you know, I would rather play it classic, but frankly, I'm not that patient, you know.
Yeah.
I have too many other games that I want to play, and I would really like to finish this game. So I'm kind of leaning towards maybe taking the path of less resistance.
I think that's fine. I mean, especially if you turn off the battle animations and just skip the videos up until that stage. I think it's like stage, I want to say it's like 8.
Yeah.
You'll you'll get there pretty quick. I mean, you haven't started any of the paralogues yet, and that's where the game can get kind of bogged down.
Yeah.
I think there's like 40 missions. So, I mean, you're still pretty early. If you're going to pull, that would be fine time to do it. And it gets harder, and then it gets a little bit easier because your party gets ridiculous.
Well, now that I'm done with Final Fantasy V, I can focus a little bit more on it. So yep. I wanted to get to that point. Okay, so that's going to wrap up new business for us, and now we're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got a little news roundup for you. Please look forward to it.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
So first this week, we have a blog, Nintendo Collector's Journal by Justin Berube.
Nice.
Justin been down to the mission and bought himself some used Nintendo toys. This is what it's come to, used Nintendo toys.
All right, and we have a blog by Andrew Brown, switching back to Pokemode, which is what I did this week. due to science, it is summer in Australia, and the summer rains left Andrew sick. He's been getting better watching box sets of the newest episodes of the Pokemon series, and wrote 796 words about how they're not as good as their predecessors, but still have charm. If you need a quick catch-up on the day and lives of Ash Ketchum, Andrew has you covered. Parents are certainly going to flock to that blog.
Next up, we have a blog called An Ode to Frederick the Wary by Josh Max. This week in Things I'm Totally Not Making Up, Josh wrote a literal ode to Fire Emblem Awakening character Frederick the Wary. Again, not making this up. A literal ode.
Yes.
An ode in 2013.
Yep, it happens.
Last this week, we have a community featured feature called Backwards Compatibility, Good or Bad, written by The Forums. We love our forums. We just don't have the time to associate with them. We're busy people, and we're totally not avoiding them. Anyway, if you have time, we have a featured topic this week. Give us your thoughts on backwards compatibility. We will not see you there.
I'm not backwards compatible with James Jones, I can tell you that. I can assure you.
That makes no sense.
That will not change Next Generation either.
But you're forwards compatible. Welcome back, everyone. It is time for the news roundup. And first up, we've got the Nintendo Direct. We didn't have a chance to talk about this last week, but there was a worldwide Nintendo Direct that mainly focused on 3DS stuff. A little bit of Wii U news came out of it. And it was the whole Year of Luigi thing that certainly was a surprising thing.
Certainly was insane.
I'm not really, I mean, other than Luigi's Mansion coming out, I'm not totally convinced that Nintendo really has anything to back up.
Well, they had the Super Mario Brothers U reskin.
Yeah. The DLC, which I guess I'm very, I think this is one of the most exciting things that was announced that day.
I'm pretty shocked by it, to be honest.
It's basically the giant expansion pack to New Super Mario U, where they're going to turn it into New Super Luigi, I guess. And they're going to redo all the levels in the game and basically give you, it sounds like, virtually double the content. We don't know what it's going to cost, but it'll be downloadable, of course. And I'm sure it will require the original game. But I think this is exciting. I mean, this is something I've been kind of hoping Nintendo would do for a long time. The way that they're doing it is interesting in that, you know, they're saying it's going to be themed around Luigi. I just wonder, what does that actually mean? You know, like, how does that inform the level designs? Is he going to control differently? Is that a good thing? You know, I mean, sometimes in these Mario games, when they make Luigi control differently, it's not really in a way that I want to, is something that I like.
Yeah, like he's paddling his feet and he's just too floaty and
Yeah, they kind of turn him into Yoshi, and Yoshi's already in the game, so that wouldn't add anything. Yeah. And if he controls the same, is it something more thematic in the style of the levels? I mean, we haven't really seen this yet, so we don't really know what this means. But hey, I think more content, especially because these are essentially single player levels. I mean, they're main game levels.
Yeah, and I think that's the most interesting and exciting part of it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they are exclusively single player, but they did explicitly say you cannot play as Mario.
Yeah. And okay. So that kind of, you know, there's a promise kind of here that they're going to be specifically designed for one player. So, like, it should feel new in that sense. Like, there is, you know, they take into consideration that there might be four players playing in the current levels. So, yeah, I'm excited about this.
So when do we get new Super Toad?
He gets no respect.
Yeah, when's that Toad game coming?
What I really like about this is that it's Nintendo kind of doing something that people have wanted them to do for a long time, which is just, you know, like, you know, not do something crazy and outside the box, but just release more of what people already like in terms of, you know, Mario games. Yeah. You know,
I mean,
like,
go ahead, John.
Well,
ahead,
I mean, I'm just saying everybody's always wanted them to release DLC for, you know, any Mario game that's been out there, and they've never done it up to this point. So,
well, they did it for the 3DS game.
They did it for 3DS, but those are specifically for Coin Rush mode. So, it's a different kind of content. You know, I mean, what excites me is that this is main game content. Like, this is the stuff that I already liked about New Super Mario Bros. U. I mean, the Coin Rush is interesting. It's a cool mode, but they're basically feeding more content for a mode that, practically speaking, I can't really make good use of because Street Pass is virtually impossible in North America. So, you know, constantly feeding more levels. Like, I could play those games as single player, but that's not really what they're made for. They're not really balanced for that. They're meant to be kind of score attack things. And when you can't actually trade scores with people, score attack is not that much fun. So I love the idea that, you know, this Luigi reskin, there could be a whole new world map for this. Like, it could be essentially the entire game redone. It could be double the content of stuff that was already the main reason that I bought this game in the first place, was that I wanted to play through it mainly as a single player game and experience all those cool levels. So if they keep up the quality and if the price is decent, I think 20, 30 bucks is a reasonable price to, you know, for 80 plus levels. Yep. That seems very reasonable to me. So I'm really excited about this. I mean, yep. I hope we get to see this at E3 and, you know, actually kind of get a feel for what it really is.
So to me, what's interesting about this is Nintendo, this is, I think, their third major, well, if you count Style Savvy, their fourth major DLC thing. Mm-hmm. So they started out with the Fire Emblem ones. Those are, you know, basically little level packs, which are cool. And they do have some neat things about them. I just spoke about them. You know, they're very distinct. They have a very weird vibe to them. They're kind of outside the main game world. They followed that up with the New Super Mario Bros. 2 coin packs, which again are outside the main game world, but are kind of this distinct fun on their own that makes them, you know, enjoyable in a way that is different from the main gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
Style Savvy is just more costumes, whatever. But, in this game, though, it's like a real full game on top of another game. It's kind of the same things that fans have done for these games in the past.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Ooh, good point. It's effectively story content. If Mario actually had a story, this would be like a new story. It's basically a new campaign, right?
Yeah, an expansion pack.
This is kind of what I was originally hoping when they announced Fire Emblem DLC they were going to do. Would just be, all right, here's like 20 more missions. Go. But I'm perfectly happy with this. I mean, I wasn't the huge fan of New Super Mario Bros. U. I was like, it's more New Super Mario Bros. Okay, I'm kind of over it. But, you know, 2 years down the road, if I'm, you know, kind of like, all right, I want something to play, knowing this is out there is a nice bonus.
Yeah.
It's not horse armor. It's not alternate costumes. It is a full reskin of a game. And yeah, it's going to be more premium than a lot of DLC out there. But it's so much more substantive than most of the DLC we get in games.
Well, and the other thing is, I mean, they are catering to fairly hardcore users with this. I mean, you have to be willing to spend $30 on a download, you know, presumably, to get this. And you probably have already played everything in the main game and still want more. So I think they know there's a fractional audience here. They're not going to sell this to every person who bought the disc or download or even downloaded the original game like I did. So they're working towards a subset, And that means that they can sort of cater to a more narrow audience. And to me, this means they can get a little crazier with things. They're probably going to ratchet up the difficulty a little bit. Hopefully not too much, because the game's already pretty challenging. But I think they can assume that you've played other Mario games, you know, even more so than normal. And I'm hoping this also means, you know, because it is a total reskin, they can put in new enemies, they can do new power-ups, they can do totally different themes, you know, art assets, different mechanics, different kinds, you know.
Say it. The music. Is this an opportunity to change the music?
Oh my God. You're overhyping this now. Let's not go crazy. You know? Let's not go crazy. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, what I would love to see them do with this is just make this more part of their norm. I mean, all their DLC sort of forays have all been relatively substantive compared to what a lot of DLC is.
Yeah.
And I'm happy with that. I don't want to see them get into the nickel and diming. Here's a $1 thing you get.
Right.
Whatever. I want to see them keep this more high level, adding real playable content to games. And this, to me, is an extreme step in that direction. Mm-hmm. This feels like staking a flag on the ground and saying, when we do DLC, we fucking mean it. This is mm-hmm. what you're going to get.
Well, they could also be, like, testing the waters. Like, I mean, like, this is the first time they do this.
Oh, they will certainly do statistics on every which way you can cut how this thing sells. And it will inform future decisions they make. Mm. But if this is what... I mean, I've always really been kind of standoffish about DLC. You know, I buy the game, I want to get the game. And it's always felt like there are publishers out there who hold content out of the game so they can sell it to you later.
Well, but that's because you realize that they're doing that, right? I mean, with this, it doesn't feel like Nintendo is actually holding anything back.
None of these have felt like that. The Fire Emblem stuff doesn't feel like that. The Mario stuff doesn't feel like that. And this definitely doesn't feel like that.
Right.
This is the most extreme form of DLC you can make.
Yeah, especially since they're taking their time to make it.
It's extreme in that they didn't announce it before the game was out.
Well, even if they did, I mean, you said this is a complete set of levels for this game. It is not this game. It is a separate entity unto itself that executes using a lot of the same art assets to save space.
Well, and the other thing is, no one could say that New Super Mario Bros. U doesn't have enough content. I mean, at this point, we have a certain expectation for how many levels are going to be in one of those games, and the Wii U game actually has even more than you would expect.
It's actually really long.
Yeah, it's really packed. I mean, there's a ton of stuff in there. So, but that's the other thing is, I mean, by the time you play through all that, especially if you play the 3DS game too, you've played a shitload of 2D Mario lately. Yeah. So that also gives me the hope that I hope they realize that and it pushes them to be even more crazy with this, you know, to really make, and this is going to be an expensive download. They really have to make this appealing. They have to do something bold that makes people say, yeah, I want to spend a lot of money on that. And I hope that really pushes them out there on the edge to do something really, really creative.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to see them do this with other games. I mean, it's hard to think of what franchises work this way, but let's say the next Zelda game, you could drop a side quest using the same engine out there, just a side story. Mm-hmm. It's like three dungeons,
yep.
$30. I'd buy that.
Everybody would.
Next console Fire Emblem game, they could say, all right, here's a sub quest starring one of the characters from the game after you finish.
Yep.
It's 20 missions.
I want to see is poison mushrooms and warp pipes that erase your progress and bring it back to World 1. That's what people want.
Invisible wind. So to stay on the Luigi theme,
We got to see Miyamoto hold up the a copy of the vacuum if you watch the Japanese one.
Yeah, I need to see that. I heard about that.
It's just weird and unsettling, and he looks really uncomfortable. He's like poking the camera with it, and Iwata's just standing there. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, Luigi's Mansion is coming out here in about a month, and I'm still excited for that at this point. I don't know if there's really anything else they could show me that would change my feelings on it. I just want them to fucking finish it, finally.
We finally saw the multiplayer, which is like basically every Ghostbusters fan's wet dream.
We call that an ectoplasm
dream.
Sure.
I will try it. That's not why I care about that game, but I'll check that out. So I think the biggest announcement that came out of this was, at least for me personally, was the new Mario and Luigi RPG for 3DS. So this is the follow-up to Bowser's Inside Story from a few years ago.
Bowser's Outside
Story. I love this series, and after the relative disappointment of Paper Mario Sticker Star, which is a game that I like in spite of itself, like it is a seriously flawed game, and yet in a lot of ways I do find it very charming, and just it's an exciting world to run around in. I still have always preferred the Mario and Luigi RPGs. I just think they're better RPGs for one thing, and they're a lot funnier.
I agree, but by the time that Bowser's Inside Story came out, I was a little bit fatigued of them, and I wonder if this game will. Because, I don't know. There's only so many times that I can enjoy. I think that this battle system. At this point, it's getting kind of old, and I'm not sure what they could do to refresh it.
Real-time strategy game. There, done.
But the writing historically has been superior, I think, in Mario & Luigi than in Paper Mario.
Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to this. I guess it has a new graphical style, so it should be different, you know, in some way. It's a 3DS game, of course, so I'm really excited for that, and I wasn't expecting to hear about it this soon after Paper Mario. But I'm
not sure
I'm not
Nintendo was planning for it either. I think they probably intended you to have Paper Mario sometime earlier.
Wait, we had this in development?
Yeah. No, that's I think true. It was more a matter of like, wait, this is still in development?
Yeah, Paper Mario was pretty long development cycle.
It was at the E3 they showed the 3DS, right?
Yeah, which was 2010?
In video form.
Yes. In video form, yeah. But I mean, I held a 3DS and watched a Paper Mario video.
Yeah.
That game took forever.
Yeah, 2.5 years later, it finally came out.
Wow. That's for a handheld game.
That's a pretty long handheld development, yeah. So anyway, there's a new Mario Golf for 3DS.
Which is by Camelot.
Do you guys care about this? I mean,
I care enough.
I have a hard time getting excited for Mario Golf.
I have a hard time getting excited about it, too. I mean, you know, it's one of those games where it's, you know, I'll probably pick it up maybe if there's a price drop on it, but, you know, because I'm confident that it'll be good and, you know, probably worthwhile, but I don't know. It's kind of like what James said. It's like they'll have to do something, or what Guillaume said, you know, it's like they'll have to do something different with it, you know.
No, they don't.
They won't, but I wish they would.
I actually like the golf games more than the tennis games, and yeah. I'm kind of I don't know. Sometimes I'm kind of nostalgic for Toadstool Tour, which I sold. And, like, even if it's more of that, I might bite.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy that it's Camelot doing it because, hey, you guys, what have you been up to? Oh, that's awesome. Good for you.
Yeah.
And but I know a lot of people are lamenting the fact that the Mario Tennis game didn't have the RPG elements that the portable versions of these games traditionally had.
I would have liked that, to be fair. I want to be able to yes and no.
I think it would have been nice, but I think that Mario Golf stands better on its own without it than tennis does.
Well, I mean, golf is just a beefier experience. You play a round of golf; it takes longer. There's more strategy to it. Tennis is tennis is a very quick kind of back and forth action game. So applying the RPG shell to it made it feel more substantial. And when you took that away on the 3DS game, all of a sudden people see this as, wow, this is really just tennis. It's kind of repetitive. Mm-hmm. And there's more variety in golf because you have course design and, you know, there's more to the game of golf in general. And so the matches just take longer to play through, and it feels like a kind of a journey as you go from one hole to the next. And so I agree with you that it's not as critical for a golf game to have the RPG stuff.
I would still like it though. I think that kind of content adds to these games immeasurably. I think the ability to sort of make the experience feel more connected from game to game is something that really these Mario sports games should try to make good use of, because ultimately they're not going to be, you know, great representation of the sport. They're going to be kind of goofy, fun, arcadey representation of the sport. And you know, there's only so many times you can play whatever they call it, Toadstool Cup, that before you'll be like, ah, this is kind of dull. But putting in these elements that give you the feeling of progression, make it feel like you're doing things differently, giving you challenges, putting in these sorts of story-based golf matches, you do get the opportunity to replay these levels without it just feeling like rote repetition.
I would just love for Camelot to finally make a great RPG. regardless of, you know, what theme they want to apply it to. I mean, I guess Shining Force 3 is supposed to be really good, but that was a long time ago, man.
Yeah, so right now Johnny is trying to be a troll. He's really shitty
at
it.
I'm not trying to be a troll. I've played a lot of their RPGs, and I think they're very kind of by the numbers and not very inspired and tedious, so.
Yeah, to me, they're good, not great. Good, not great.
Yeah, yeah. We've also got Mario and Donkey Kong. It's not Mario versus DK. It's Mario and DK. It's about the 20th game in the series that Nintendo Software Technologies has made.
So is it really them who are making it?
I think so, yeah.
Because it feels like when I was looking at it, I was like, wow, they handed this off to Skip. Because it looks so much like art style games, like kind of a collection.
It does look very different from all the other Mario versus Donkey Kong games, and
it's probably actually the game that I'm most excited for out of the you know, all these announcements.
What?
It looks cool.
I think it looks really interesting. Really does.
I know. I just would never have expected that ever in 100,000 years.
Well, like all the rest are kind of known quantities, right? Like Mario Golf, we've played three of them before, at least four. And, you know, Mario and Luigi is the fourth one. There's a lot of stuff that we've already seen. Now, this is a part of a series as well, but it doesn't look anything like the other games. So, sure, yeah I'm excited.
It looks like a pretty hard left turn for this franchise. So, I'm with you, man. I'm actually very intrigued by the video that I saw of this. And I'm hoping this is kind of an eShop title. I don't know if they confirmed that or not, but I would love for this to be kind of a lower priced, you know, something that's a little bit easier to get your hands on. And that's what they've been doing mostly with the Versus games lately. They've mostly been downloadable. Mm-hmm. It's a good series, and the puzzles are actually very well thought out, and the mechanics are really interesting. And even in the previous games, they changed them significantly from game to game. Some of them are more platformers. Some of them are just really touch based puzzle games. And this one just looks really zany. If you haven't seen the video yet, I really would recommend going to watch it. It'll surprise you. So we don't know a whole lot about it yet, but I'm looking forward to that. And then finally, the other big announcement that we got from Nintendo Direct was, drum roll please.
You're already dead?
Donkey Kong Country Returns 3D.
Oh yeah, let's return this. So I was at work when this happened, and I thought, oh my god, they made another one? That's awesome. And then I realized, oh no, they literally returned to this game.
Yeah. It should be called Donkey Kong Country Returns Returns.
Yeah. It was kind of weird to kind of position it as this like one more thing Nintendo Direct, because it's just a port, right?
So it is, well, there may be some enhancements, I don't know. But here's the thought pattern behind it, and I understand. When that game came out, things were already somewhat dire on Wii. They weren't the end of the world bad, but they weren't at the peak anymore. And I imagine Nintendo thinks there are sales that game didn't get that they could get now.
But it was actually a huge hit.
It was.
Even in Japan. I mean, it was an American-made game, and even in Japan, it was actually really successful.
I just think they feel like they have a chance here at A, getting people they missed before, and B, getting some resubs.
Yeah, and I think they're probably right. Like, I'm sure it will sell to a lot of people.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It'll sell fine. I cannot be excited for this. I mean, I wasn't the biggest fan of this game in the first place. I like it, and I enjoyed my time with it, and there's a lot of things that I really like about it. But it wasn't really what I wanted Retro to be working on at the time. And I could see, hey, you know, they're stretching themselves, they're challenging themselves with a different kind of game, and they did an excellent job with it. I can't complain about that, but there are lots of companies that know how to make good 2D platformers. There are not lots of companies that know how to make good first-person adventure puzzle shooter games.
Yeah, but
Retro's not one of them.
This is not their main team working on this, I'm sure. Like,
well,
they
don't even
know
if it's Retro at all. I mean, this could be Grezzo.
But I'm fairly sure that the guy they hired from, you know, who used to work on Uncharted is not working on this port.
Yeah, let's hope so. Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with this. If this lets more people play a good game, I have no problem with it. The only thing that potentially pisses me off about this game is if it is sucking a lot of resources out of Retro Studios. I think at their peak, at least, it's hard to say now because people have left the company and we're not, you know, we don't know very much about what the current situation at Retro is because they're so secretive. But at their peak, I think we're one of the best game developers in the world. And I do not want them porting games to handhelds. That is not worthy of their main team's talent. So I really hope you're right, Guillaume. I really hope that this is kind of a pet project, or maybe they've hired on some extra people to just work on this. And if that's the case, fine.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume it's probably just a small team working on it, and it's the kind of thing that they just do to keep the lights on, you know?
And if you remember how the Wii version was received, a lot of people saw some of the levels where there's a lot going on in the background and you have to avoid boulders, let's say, that are rolling towards you, and said like, whoa. And the 3DS had just been revealed or just came out, and people said, whoa, this would make a lot of sense on 3DS. It almost feels to me like someone at Retro or at Nintendo saw people talking about that and were like, oh shit, they're right. And then started working on a port.
I get it. Wouldn't it make more sense to make a sequel on 3DS? I don't, this is not very appealing to me.
I don't know. To me, here's what this project is. Nintendo probably had a team in-house working on a kit for porting Wii developed games to 3DS. And this would serve a couple different purposes. Companies who had Wii games in the can that they didn't put out for whatever reason could freely, without paying, port their Wii game down to the 3DS. They probably had some projects they had started on they wanted to be able to move, and they probably had some games they thought, potential candidates for re-release. Mm-hmm. They did this, and then they went through their history and said, what game could we port? And they probably came up with this one. Or they used this as one of the tech demos.
I remember, like, wasn't the team, like, didn't the team really, really just like the original game? Like, they were huge fans of it?
Yeah.
I mean, it could be they just said, hey, we wouldn't mind porting that game over because just we love that game so much that we made. You know, it could be as simple as that. Like, hey, tell us a game that you would like to port over. Oh, well, why don't we port over, you know, DKC Returns?
I mean, are you really going to ask that of this team has made 4 games ever. You mean, which of the 4 games you've made over the past decade would you most like to port to 3DS? That doesn't make sense.
No, I really do think this was probably part of a larger initiative to develop some kind of technology.
You could be right. I mean, James, do you remember back when GBA was first being kind of shopped around as Atlantis, you know, back in like 1999? The tech demo that they were going around and showing people, and actually they weren't even showing this to press. This was the tech demo that Nintendo provided to developers to show them the capabilities of the GBA hardware, was a port of Yoshi's Story. Which at the time was only about a year old. So it was a pretty new console N64 game running on this handheld. And at the time, that was very impressive, you know, and that was kind of their showpiece. It was literally a tech demo and never came out as a retail product. It was just to show developers what they could do with the power of the GBA. And I could see it is very possible that this game, this port of Donkey Kong Country Returns, started out in a similar manner. And at some point, Nintendo said, actually, this really works well. Maybe we should actually put this on the market. I mean, I could see that.
Yep, I can see that too.
And this is also the opportunity for Nintendo to sell this game online with 100% profit.
Oh, that's a good point. That's an excellent point, actually. Yeah, well, if you've never played it, I would recommend that you play it. It's a really good game. And I think there's certainly room for improvement in the controls. That's been, you know,
I can't wait
till
you have
to
shake the 3DS to make it work. Oh, I would love that just to piss off the fans who were so anal about it last time.
Oh, you see that you have to press X, you know, during certain, like when you're fighting, like an end of level boss.
Don't worry, they'll
take
that out of the final build. It'll be fine.
Oh, okay.
Honestly, they should make motion control an option. Just, you know, like it disables the 3D. But
by
just
default,
for the really weird people who loved the motion, the waggle in the Wii game, they should make it an option.
So many broken hinges.
So that was the Nintendo Direct for 3DS. There's another one happening like any hour now, I think, in Japan, that's supposed to focus on third-party stuff for 3DS. I would imagine a lot of the games they're going to show there are not going to come over. Or
I think it was like this morning, wasn't it?
There wasn't a whole lot, if I recall correctly.
They showed some Shin Megami Tensei 4.
Which is a big deal if you're a fan of Shin Megami Tensei.
It's a big deal in Japan, maybe.
Oh, they showed some Tomodachi Collection for some reason.
Because that game makes millions and millions and millions
of
yen.
They gave some details for, you know, like now we know that you can play online the 3DS version of Monster Hunter, but you have to connect your 3DS to your Wii U.
What?
First off, let me point out real quickly, before we proceed off that point, that Capcom has been tweeting about the fact that if you pre-order the 3DS version of Monster Hunter on Monster Hunter and the Wii U version together on Amazon, they'll give you $20 back.
Yeah, that's a great deal.
It is a great deal.
Except for the fact you're buying the same game two times.
Yeah, but you're transferring, like, this is kind of the
they're transferring,
the Vita.
Yes, this is transferring, yes.
It's essentially the same game content, yes, but with very different capabilities.
I know, but it's like, hey guys, we have a great deal for you. I'm like, but it's the same game.
It's a lot better deal than paying full price for both, which is what we expected it to be.
Or just buy one.
But as to the content of this morning's Nintendo Direct, it's we do have a lot of news on NintendoWorldReport.com.
Yeah, the Oracle games are coming to the 3DS. That was one of the more.
That's awesome.
One of the more.
Okay.
Because I actually haven't played those.
I got the Monster Hunter Online thing wrong. You have to buy a LAN adapter for your Wii U.
What the fuck?
And
that's just bizarre.
You know, I guess it uses the Wi-Fi to connect the 3DS to the Wii U so that you can play online on the 3DS.
Oh my god, Capcom, you're the best!
It's just like...
Jesus!
I don't know.
So you have to use Wi-Fi and LAN Ethernet connection.
Yeah,
at
like
the
same it's very
time.
Simple. Since the Wi-Fi is used up, is you know, occupied by the 3DS on the Wii U, you have to use a LAN adapter. It makes perfect sense.
Oh, right, because you can only have one Wi-Fi connection at a time.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. Or what they could do is fucking patch the 3DS game and add internet play, but I guess that is too hard.
Capcom, never change. Never, ever change.
This series cracks me up. Well, by the way, speaking of Monster Hunter, in North America, there are demos for both versions now on the respective eShops. So this crazy-ass 3DS internet thing aside, you might want to check it out on either or both platform. So let's move on from Nintendo Direct stuff and talk about a little bit of a downer, and maybe a lot bit.
Nintendo stock.
Last week, right around the time we recorded the strategy episode with Billy, we found out that the NPD sales numbers came out, and we don't have the exact numbers because NPD doesn't directly release the exact numbers anymore, but based on a number of different clues and sort of hints from people who do have the real numbers, we found out that Wii U sold about 55,000 consoles in the month of January in North America, which is real bad.
Yeah.
When I saw that number, I thought, wow, that sucks. But it wasn't until, you know, some of the news analysis came out, on various websites and really kind of broke it down. If you look at the historical comparisons, it's probably the worst post-launch January of any console ever released.
Yeah, they said it sold less than the worst months for both PS3 and 360.
Ever. It's worse than GameCube did in its first January. It's worse than Saturn did in its first January.
Oh,
of course, God,
Saturn
was released in Saturn launched in May, so a little bit different situation there, but. It's real fucking bad, man. Real bad sales. Yep. And it's not supply constrained. You can go out and buy a Wii U. They're not that hard to find.
Yeah. Yep.
So, I didn't expect them to be good, but I didn't expect them to be this bad. So I just kind of want to throw it out to you guys. How do you feel about this? Like, is this a real downer for you, or are you just shrugging it off and saying, whatever, man, it's going to get better? Do you think Nintendo needs to do something about
now? Why would you buy a Wii U right now?
Yeah, that's exactly it, right?
This isn't a trolling, baiting. I'm not trying to link bait this topic. What would you buy it for right now? If you really wanted Mario, you already have it.
Yeah.
So what game is out there screaming, you need to get a Wii U this instant to go play it?
Yeah.
GameCube had one. GameCube had a few games right at launch that were, you know, I mean, for God's sakes, Rogue Leader was probably the result of a sacrificed baby. I mean, look at that game.
Smash Brothers and Pikmin were, you know, really big deals.
Right. We had games, all of the games, in that it had Wii Sports, which is the only game.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also launched with a new Zelda game.
Yeah.
It did. But, I mean, that game also came out on
Wii. It's easy to say, well, look, Wii U launched with a new Mario game, but it's not like it had been 3 or 4 or 5 years even since the last Mario game.
No, I get
game.
That, but new Super Mario Bros. Games do sell.
Oh, yeah, but a new Zelda coming out is an event. A new 2D Mario game coming out at this point
is January.
It's just not that special of an event anymore.
Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I'm serious. What would you buy the Wii U for right now?
I don't have one right now, because I don't have an answer to that.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing. There's no game that I need to play.
You would buy it because you've been exposed to the incredibly effective marketing that's everywhere right now.
What marketing? Yeah. Nintendo, you've got like 100 billion yen. Go spend some money on marketing.
Nintendo is really paying for their mistakes with the way that they handled the Wii towards the last few years.
Yeah.
Just letting it die. And, you know, like, Wii U came in when the Wii had lost all momentum. So it's not really fresh in people's minds. Like, they can't rely on the success of the Wii to make the Wii U a success. And I don't have a degree in marketing, but I don't need one to tell you that not mentioning in your advertising that the Wii U is a new console is the stupidest move that you could ever make. Yeah. Yeah. And still today, people still think that the tablet, that the gamepad is an accessory.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's also their own fault for putting out so many damn Wii accessories.
The name of the console is not just bad, it's also not very clear that this is a new console.
Yeah.
And as much as I hate pronouncing Wii U, the much more severe issue with it is that when I tell people that I've been playing Wii U, it's not immediately apparent to them that it's a new system, you know?
Yeah.
And sharply because there were so many fucking accessories for Wii. I mean, the fitness pad, you know, the balance board that they did for Wii Fit is bigger than the gamepad, you know? I mean, why isn't that its own system? Like, it's just not logical. And if you don't show people new games that do things they've never seen before and that look totally next gen and just different from anything that's out there, then it's just not going to be super obvious to them that this is a new system. I think that's a very real problem.
Before the Wii U came out, we were wondering, like, how is Nintendo going to sell this to people? How are they going to convey what this thing does? But
and we found out they aren't.
Well, exactly. Yeah, not only they can't manage to do that, they can't even convey that this is a thing, that this, like, what it is at its most basic level, which is new hardware. Yeah. Like, they can't even get that across.
I haven't seen a single Wii U ad that wasn't tied to a game, a third-party game, no less, in 2 months, probably. And it's, what the hell? Seriously, do something. I mean, I wonder if it's just they don't know what messaging to put out there, and they'd rather put nothing out there than put out bad or ineffectual messaging. But do something.
Well, and that's a big part of the problem. I mean, they're trying to sell this thing, and they have, from the very beginning, they've tried to sell this thing on third-party support, which, if you zoom in on only the launch, the third-party support was pretty good, okay? Mm-hmm. I think the prospect for third-party support is pretty bad. It does not look good going forward, especially with these sales numbers. But for the launch itself, good third-party support. The problem is, all of those games you can play on other systems, so it's really not a selling point. If you're going to buy a Wii U anyway, the option to buy all these multi-platform third-party games on the system is really nice, and I've taken advantage of it. But no one's going to buy a Wii U so they can play Call of Duty.
Yep.
That doesn't even make sense. Yep. No one could think that way. So they've got to support it with first-party software, and there just isn't. It doesn't exist.
I don't see anything on the horizon. Well,
exactly. That's the thing, right? There's been a gap. I was looking, and there's been a gap. So just Nintendo published titles. It launched on November 18th. March 18th is the next Nintendo published title that's going to be released. Not even Nintendo developed.
Which is
Nintendo published.
Lego City Undercover.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's a 4-month gap. What the hell is that?
Which, to be fair, I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, okay. I mean, it'll be a good game, but I mean, what the hell is that? A 4-month gap?
Yeah.
For Nintendo published titles, and there's no Nintendo developed title even on the horizon.
It feels like an end of GameCube drought, not a launch.
Yeah, it's just really weird.
So, John, if you remember, you, myself, and Johnny at PAX 2011 had just gotten through the Mario Sports Mix demo on the Wii, and we had just heard what the release date was. Mm-hmm. And we sat there and did the math, and realized Nintendo hadn't put out a game for the Wii in 6 months at that point.
Yeah. Yep.
And I remember us thinking, why the fuck would you do that?
Yeah.
And we find out, oh, they're going to do that to launch a new console. That's unconscionable. I mean,
And I don't want to downplay the quality of their two launch titles. I mean,
they're fine.
I think two launch titles is not enough for any system to, you know, first party launch titles. But I think it's not an unreasonable number, and they're not bad games. But the problem is the Mario game is very difficult to make people understand what makes it different. And frankly, there's not even that much that makes it different from other Mario games.
I mean, I played it like a Mario game.
It's just not a sexy product. It's a good product. It's a good game. I really, really like it. But it's not a system seller, okay? It's just not. And Nintendo Land is a pretty interesting package, but it's fucking impossible to explain to people.
Yeah, it's... I mean, basically, you just have to just play it. You'll get it.
There is no TV commercial that sells Nintendo Land. You can't make it. It's such a complicated package. I've had people come over and play Nintendo Land multiple times at my house in local multiplayer, and they probably couldn't describe to you what it is.
But, I mean, what Nintendo really needed at their launch was they needed something that was distinct. They needed either a new franchise or a franchise they haven't done in a while doing something different.
Yep.
And that really wasn't there.
And that's kind of the philosophical problem I have with Nintendo Land, as much as I respect the package that it is. It feels like Nintendo hedging bets. It feels like, you know, we have all these kind of half fulfilled ideas for how you might use this gamepad, but we don't really think any of them is mature enough at this point to really build a whole game around. So we're just going to throw a bunch of half baked shit into a package and make it look really nice and make it nostalgic. And we're going to sell you this package, but it shows a very clear lack of commitment to how do you use this system to create a unique kind of game. And I don't think Mario does it either.
It's kind of telling that they left, for some reason, they kind of left Ubisoft the task of doing that, of making the game that's more, you know, fleshed out and that shows a potential use of, that makes, you know, use of the gamepad in an interesting way.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to an extent, there's always never trust Ubisoft to do anything. Joe.
Well, yeah, but, that goes without saying.
But I mean, you could show... Zombie was the kind of game that they could show that you could make. I mean, you could try to base an ad campaign around. I mean, you could it's outside of character. It does things that are distinctly possible on that system. Although I don't know that it does anything that greatly says you can only do this on Wii U. I mean, grant the tablet stuff, sure, but is it really that integral to the game that you have that? I don't know.
I mean, the way that the inventory works in that game, you could put it on the TV screen and still make it in real time. And I think it is very possible that a port or a sequel to Zombie U will appear on other systems. I think it is very possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have no problem with that because I still think it'll probably be best suited to the Wii U. But right. I don't think there's anything about that game that makes it absolutely impossible to adapt to other systems.
Now, here's
Ubisoft being what they are, they probably will try it.
So, ironically enough, they announced today that Watch Dogs is coming to the Wii U. So.
Yeah, which is great.
Yeah, and actually that game could be really, really cool on the tablet because of what you're doing. In that game, you walk around with the fucking cell phone and hack things.
Yeah.
That's what you do.
Yeah. But that announcement is one of the reasons why I'm not too worried about the future. Like, I don't think that publishers... You know, like, so far, publishers have been spreading their games around. Like, they want to be multi-platform because that's the surest way that they'll make back their money. And I don't think that they're ready quite yet to count Nintendo out completely. And I don't think that the PS4 inspires them enough confidence that perhaps even like Microsoft's console. Like right now, like I think they're still going to try.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're already hedging their bets by putting games out on both the same game out on both the PS3 and PS4. So that means that they'll have no problem porting stuff to Wii U.
Yeah.
To me, this is what Nintendo should really do to get publishers satiated. Say, look,
we know the online
sale is way more profitable than the retail sale. We're going to cut our cut of the online sales of retail games down to basically a processing fee and a little bit of cash. And, you know, we want you to put all of your stuff on the system day and date with release date. We don't want there to be any exceptions, and you're going to get 90% of the money that comes in on that sale.
That's interesting.
Devs would shit themselves. 90% of the return on the $60 price of a game, that would be a profit margin publishers have never seen before in the console space.
They would probably be, their net take home would probably be at least double what they get from a retail sale.
At least.
Yeah. That would be very, very alluring. But I think I'm glad you brought up digital sales, James, because the other thing we heard last week is that retail software sales for Wii U are even worse than console sales. That concerns me less because I do think a significant portion of Wii U owners are downloading their games, and those are not going to show up in MPD results. So I'm not as worried about Wii U games not showing up on MPD sales charts, because a lot of people, myself included, are buying games digitally now.
Yep. I mean, I think that's kind of skewed MPDs across the board. I mean,
everybody's MPDs look like buying this game.
But I'm kind of scratching my head. Like, the Call of Duty is still not downloadable, is it, on the Wii U? And yet it came out on PSN like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah. It's
so
totally
what's going
insane
on?
That I mean, game isn't
it,
out.
It almost feels like Nintendo should, in part and parcel with this, like, look, you're going to take them a big cut deal, say, also, your games need to be day and date online.
Well, and it's bad business for them to not do it. And I think about this, Activision could have gotten $60 out of me if they'd put Call of Duty Black Ops 2 on the eShop. Instead, I paid $30 at Best Buy, which means they probably got $12 out of that.
After all
the costs and everything. So they're leaving money on the table. You know, all they had to do was put that game out on the eShop on launch day, and they would have gotten all of my money. And instead, they got very, very little of it.
Mm-hmm. So to me,
Best Buy did.
Best Buy got some money. I mean, we have a sale right now. Zombies on sale for $40 online on the eShop.
That's a pretty good deal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's plus whatever you get back if you're a rewards member.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Nintendo...
10%.
So let's say Nintendo says, all right, we're going to keep 10% to cover the reward money.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'll keep another 2% to cover our costs and give us a little bit of lining in the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
You get 88% of the price of the game.
I mean, it's hard for Nintendo to do that because those licensing fees are a significant part of their income.
Yeah.
But you think about how much more they're making on first-party digital sales, where they keep all the money, and they're making money on selling the consoles. You know,
see, that's what I'm thinking. The first-party games are going to be the big sellers on their system anyway.
Yeah, and they're making hand over fist on that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, think about what the profit margin is going to be on anybody who buys that Luigi DLC. If you average out the cost of developing on a game engine with art assets that already existed.
Mm-hmm.
A level pack, probably using your C-list developer teams, you know, your trainers or whatever. Well, average out to be like probably 10 cents a copy sold at the most.
And you're selling it for $30.
They're selling for $30.
Yeah,
that means,
that's why they're doing it, you know, and I'm very happy about that. But,
that's like 30,000% profit margin.
So James, that's a very good idea that you have about how to get third parties, sort of juice to maybe commit a little bit stronger to the system. I think in terms of Nintendo motivating people to actually buy the system, they're in a very tough spot because the games that are going to do that are not coming anytime soon, as we've talked about.
No.
And I think about, you know, like even Pikmin 3, which I don't even think is a huge system seller either, but that game may not even come out till after E3, right? And that's like the first thing on the horizon that actually has kind of name recognition and is something that people might get really excited
about.
But
that's still a pretty niche game.
Yeah, it's a pretty niche game, but that's a long time. That's a long ways away.
It's been almost 10 years since Pikmin 2.
Here's my theory here. The 3D Mario game has already been 3D landed. In that, if you remember, 3D Land really got its dev cycle pushed really hard because it needed something for the 3DS. I think the reason we didn't see it at the Wii U Nintendo Direct, but the reason they announced it exists, isn't just because Nintendo wanted us, no, really, this game exists, is because they've gotten the marching orders, this game comes out this year.
Oh, yeah.
And that that may not have been the original plan.
So let me throw out an idea, and I think I've proposed this in past years and it was kind of scoffed at. Maybe the infrastructure wasn't there. But I really like this. I think this might actually help get people interested in the system even before the games come out. And that is E3 this year, Nintendo actually lets you download some of their game demos for games that aren't, maybe all of them, but I mean first party stuff. But their demos are always really polished. They're not buggy. They don't crash. So they're going to do that anyway, just for the people who are at E3. And what I'm saying is, if you let people download a demo of Wind Waker HD and of the new 3D Mario game and of Pikmin 3 and of whatever else is coming out through the end of 2013, even though those games aren't coming out anytime soon, they're still going to be a couple months. I think the passion that people have for games like Mario and Zelda might actually convince them to go pick up a system just to play the demo. Because they know, that's what people say. I'm waiting to buy a Wii U because I'm waiting for the Marios and the Zeldas and the Metroids to come out. If you give them a taste of it, at least, a taste that you're already gonna develop for the show, and you actually let people download that from the eShop, I think it's a low risk proposition. I think potentially some people might say, you know what, I might go ahead and buy the system now because I want to play those demos.
So here's a way to make that a harder push. They announced that at a Nintendo Direct a couple weeks before E3. They say, all of our demos are going to go playable live as soon as we finish our press event.
Yeah.
For us, we probably get in the car and drive back to the hotel. Because why fucking bother? They're already there.
E3 is too loud. Let's just go back and
But, I mean, for us, it would suck for our site traffic. But they announce it ahead of time and say, but the demos will only be up during the duration of E3.
Oh.
They've now put a fatalistic push for you to go buy a Wii U in that 3-week window. And they just keep reminding you, hey, if you have a Wii U, during the time of E3, you'll be able to get all of our demos.
Yep.
And then a week after it, they put those demos back out.
They get the system in homes. And then you say, well, you know, the Mario game that I really care about is not coming out for another 6 months. But until then, I've got the system. I might as well buy something for it, you know.
And those demos don't get to eat away at sales because you've pulled them off.
Like, honestly, I don't know what else you can do because you can't just make games appear out of thin air. I mean, these things take time to make, and clearly Nintendo has fucked up real bad on the scheduling for their development cycles. And things have been delayed, and things have just not materialized, and it's a bad situation. And I'm thinking,
it looks to me like they're backing themselves into another 3DS top price cut.
Yeah, and they really want to avoid that. And I'm just trying to think, how can they get out of this corner? I don't know. E3 demos is the best I got. It's a tough situation.
Here's one perk they have. It already sounds like, based on what we've heard, Sony's priced themselves in a whole other stratosphere yet again.
who knows, though? I mean, like,
I'm not convinced about that.
I mean, we're hearing $535. The five number shouldn't be the first number in the price of your console.
They're using off-the-shelf PC parts, which means they're mass-produced, and that's a big help.
That's a big help, and also I think that they could get away with having, like, you know, it. Like the Wii, having a deluxe one and a basic one. I think they can easily get away with that.
You can't gimp the basic one. And it's, a lot of times they do. They just go like kneecap thing. It's like, guys.
I think Nintendo has shown you don't have to do that. I mean, I think the basic Wii U is not gimped. It's just less appealing.
Not.
But if
it's
that
not.
$50 really matters to you, then it's a good option. I think in Sony's case, it's probably going to be at least $100 if John is right.
Yeah.
And so that starts to look like, hey, man, that's a pretty big difference.
How
and if
do
I don't
you,
care about the things that are in the, you know,
how
the collector's
do you cut
$100 edition, then
from the price of your console, though? You can't do it from hard drive space anymore. Hard drive space is immaterially cheap.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking, like, you know, like the premium one could have like a free year of PS Plus or something like that. or like,
yeah, I mean, it,
whatever.
Maybe it comes with that.
And then it costs $110 to get PS Plus for a year.
Maybe it comes with that Kinect sensor, which I think will likely be optional. You know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of things they could do. It could come with an extra controller, you know. Anyway, yeah, I mean, PS4 price is not coming anytime soon, but I did kind of want to talk about PS4 a little bit, and I just think it's interesting. I mean, I have a PS3, I've owned all the PlayStations, and I like them, so, you know, it's not super relevant to Nintendo, mainly just because I don't really think Nintendo's going to respond whatsoever to PS4. I think Nintendo's going to do whatever they're going to do, and I think their problems are their problems. They're not caused by the competition, they're caused by the market realities and their own mistakes, you know. And if they save themselves, it will be because they do a smart thing, not because the other systems fail,
right?
You know,
so I mean, that Kohler had an interesting point on his podcast this week, where he basically talking about these numbers, where he said it's a company full of talented and creative people that sometimes are a little too creative for their own goods, but they have a ton of money and they could pull whatever rabbits they need to survive. Whether or not they're successful depends on how creative they end up being in the correct way.
And you're referring to Nintendo, not Sony, right?
Yes, Nintendo. No. I don't think, based on his link bait article about the PS3, I don't think he has anything like that to say about, or the PS4, excuse me. I don't think he has anything to say about Sony like that.
We really, really got to end this show. So unfortunately, we didn't get to listener mail. We will kick those forward to next week. And we'll add on some extra ones as well, so you can get in your email for the show, and we will talk about whatever you want us to talk about. Send those to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Also wanted to remind people, this is probably your last chance, if you listen to this fairly soon after it launches, the podcast, this is probably going to be your last chance to vote in Retroactive. And the
your
poll has
vote
been,
counts.
It really does. I mean... but the poll has been exceedingly tight throughout, and which tells me that, you know, we came across a pretty good crop of games, and people are interested in all of them. The vote, as the last time I checked, it was very, very, very tight, a multi-way race, more than two. So if you haven't voted yet, and you hear this before Thursday, the 28th of February, the last day of the month, if you hear this before then, please go vote, because we really do want you to participate. And then on the next episode of RFN, we will announce the winner and start playing the next Retroactive game. And one last thing, our friend Nick Bray from Australia, he's a staff member over at NWR, he puts together the layouts and does a lot of the content planning for NWR Powered Off, which is the PDF digital magazine version of the website that has really nice reproductions of some of the best content from the website, and you know, some of it recent, some of it sort from the archive.
Some of it exclusive to the article as well.
That's right. So it has some original exclusive content that is only in Powered Off.
I am a featured writer every month, so you can skip at least two pages.
That means you can pretty much avoid James aside from that one time a month. It's pretty good.
That's right. Just that time of the month again.
I actually have an article in issue 3, which will be going out pretty soon, I think, after this podcast airs. I did an article where I looked back at the critical reception of Pikmin back in 2001, and at the various responses back then of how all of our staff members and even Mr. Miyamoto felt on this question of whether Pikmin is a strategy game. So if you enjoyed that part of the discussion last week, I think you'll find the article really, really interesting. It's a fun look back at some of the classic content that we had. So anyway, Nick also wanted me to remind everyone that they're trying to get some mail for the magazine. So if you ever read Nintendo Power or EGM, you know, people write in letters. Sometimes people include artwork. You can do that as well. But they're looking for your questions, your stories, your fan art, whatever. And you can send all of that to poweredoff@nintendoworldreport.com. for a future issue, and I'll put that link in the show notes for this episode as well. So if you can't remember it, you can always go to the article and click on that. But they're really trying to get some participation kicked off for that, and I said I would be happy to mention it on our show. So I hope you will check that out. And if nothing else, be sure to download Powered Off. It's a very, very cool thing that we do. And I think you'll be impressed by it. So that's all for this week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And we'll talk to you next time right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Later.
Bye. Bye.
John Linneman will be here later, we're told. He's running a little bit late, but unlike last week, I have some degree of confidence that he
suspend
will be here.
Suspend your disbelief.
And he actually has new business this week, and it's actually a game, it's a Nintendo game that is recent that we've never talked about on the show, so I would really like to get him on here, and hopefully he will be popping in shortly.
He's talking about Style Savvy.
But speaking of...
speaking of John Linneman, there he is right now.
I know, hey, a lot of people are looking forward to that. I'm not hating on Monster Hunter. I don't get it, but that doesn't mean I think it's bad. I mean, I think the controls are bad.
You're just afraid of big swords. And
big
and
sexy
lances
swords.
And bow guns, all right?
John knows all about the bow guns.
Bow guns. I live it. I breathe it. I'm on the cover of Bowgun Weekly, all right?
I'll probably check out the Wii U game just to see it in HD, just to see what it looks like, you know, because I'm just kind of curious about it. And I've got a terabyte now, so I'm going to download everything.
Just think about how many monsters you can fit in there, Johnny.
I know. How many HD monsters?
How many HD monsters you can fit in there once you buy a LAN adapter?
A full-size Regagalos. And
honestly, Capcom, that can't
a
be a name that you thought was...
It'd be amazing.
Bomafuga.
How are those giant monsters going to fit through the Ethernet cable?
I don't know.
They're going to have to stretch
out a little
bit. I don't
know. It's a wonder of modern technology, Johnny. I don't know.
Oh, man.
I didn't even know there was an Ethernet adapter for the Wii U.
I guess it was announced today.
They sent Nintendo the press release, and it's like, we don't have an Ethernet adapter.
This is amazing.
Okay, make one right now.
An accessory that didn't make sense for GameCube back in 2005 is now coming to Wii U in 2013.
It's not amazing. That's Nintendo.
That's incredible.
Capcom, why? Why do you do this?
I hope they call it the Internet Pro.
Yep. Well done.
Fun fact, I actually registered a Twitter account that was basically just called something like not the actual Capcom, where I was going to tweet shit like this and it got instantly banned. Thanks, Capcom. This is the kind of shit I was going to make up.
Oh, man.
But no, they went and did it for me.
Yeah. I mean, the PS4 does, you know, on paper, it looks like, you know, a pretty decent powerhouse in terms of technical abilities. I think the network stuff that they talked about is really interesting. I feel like a lot of it probably won't actually work the way that you think it will. You know, stuff like, and a lot of people think Nintendo really needs to be concerned because Sony is saying that they want every PS4 game to be playable remotely through a Vita.
That you don't own.
And people are saying that, you know, this is really a shot across the bow at Nintendo.
No one owns a Vita.
That's the thing. No, I mean, I would believe that if the Vita wasn't $300 and it didn't have a 32 gig card that cost $90.
$300 Sony today announced they're not cutting the price in the West.
Exactly.
Even price aside, my concern for this feature, I mean, it's really exciting. You know, if it actually works, it's amazing. I just don't think it's actually going to work. I mean, remote play on PSP is not very impressive, and I don't really know anyone who uses it actively. And there are severe latency issues with doing this. And if you read the Iwata Asks, where they talk about the wireless technology that's in the Wii U gamepad and the way that the protocols that they created, you know, proprietary, they invented wireless methods for the system to talk to the gamepad in a way that the latency is so low that you can't perceive it. It's subliminal. Yep. And I'm not very convinced that Sony's going to be able to pull that off, considering that the Vita was developed like 2 years ago.
Right. It's
I don't
being
think they're
going
to be able to retrofit
that's
this
the
thing,
though,
to make it as
you have
smooth
to realize
of an experience.
That it's really not the Vita so much as they're just like basically stuffing what Gaikai has been working on in there. So the Gaikai stuff that's going to be powering this has been vetted. And it actually works pretty well. How well it's going to work on the Vita, I don't know, but that actual tech has been vetted very well. So,
I don't know. Okay, it feels a bit like it feels. I mean, the press conference felt a bit. I mean, it was a Sony press conference, so you have things like you'll be able to play in the cloud. You'll be able to play games wherever you.
Sony just like, promises the world. I mean,
am I really going to want to play God of War on my cell phone? No, of course I'm fucking not going to want to play God of War on my cell phone.
It's another Sony, you know, press conference where they promised the world emotion, man. This is going to be finally. All those other consoles, they didn't matter.
Yeah, we had an emotion engine.
We just fucked those up. This is going to be the one where you're going to finally see the emotion in your characters.
My favorite line was, oh shoot, what's the David Cage game?
Beyond Two Souls.
Yeah.
No, the predecessor, the PS3 one.
Have you read?
Heavy Rain.
Yeah, so they talked about how many polygons made up characters, and they went to...
I know, that was awesome.
In Heavy Rain, it was 13,000 characters. I'm like, it was 13,000 Jasons! they talked about how many polygons it takes to make an old man cry.
Yeah, see, that was kind of where I went into, like, sort of... That was, like, just sort of old-school Sony, like, 8-bit versus 16-bit. 16-bit is better, like, you know what I mean? Like, that kind of stuff. Like, TurboGrafx-16, it's 16-bit because it has... You know, 4 4-bit processors. So it's like, this just cracked me up.
Stop it! Just stop talking right now.
I know. Just stop.
Yeah. See, the beauty of a Sony press conference, and as a semi-professional press conference Twitter troll, Sony's are the easiest.
They are,
because you're just like, oh my god, what the fuck are you talking about right now?
The whole thing with like the whole move sculpting thing, that's so classic to me, because that is the kind of thing where you're watching it and you're like, wow, I bet you everybody at Sony thinks this is fucking amazing, but everybody else is like, why are you forcing us to watch this? It's just not interesting.
It
was Wonderbook all over again. I swear, Sony just tries to entertain themselves more than anybody else at their press conferences.
It's amazing. My favorite response I got was, I just tweeted at the very end that PS4 is apparently invisible.
Yep.
Because I didn't show it. And Minoru responds, because it's on cloud. To which point I asked him, does PS4 rain? And he said, we'll see at E3.
Nicely done. I'm not even that surprised that we didn't see the console.
Yeah.
Because it just doesn't matter. I mean, the shape of the box, it really doesn't matter.
No, it is really weird to do a console announcement and be like, yeah, what am I going to show it?
Actually, the funny thing I thought of, it's the way that they unveiled this is almost the total opposite of the Revolution back in 2005. You remember,
because
that
console,
E3, Nintendo showed the console and nothing else. No games, no controllers, no specs. Nothing. Here's the box. That's
Here
all you get.
Here's a plastic shell.
And Sony was like, here's everything but the box.
Mm-hmm. Oh, because it's on cloud.
No, I think the controller is a little bit ugly, but has a lot of really good ideas
in it.
It
looks like a
Nyko
controller.
And it looks more comfortable than the PS3 controller. I think it looks like a nice functional upgrade. And, you know, I think the stuff that they're talking about with Network is all really, really cool ideas. If they actually make it work the way that they say it will, it'll be a big deal, you know?
It's not very practical for a lot of people, though, because I can't even download eShop games at, you know, a cafe at a free local Wi-Fi spot. And I've got download caps, so I don't think I'm going to be streaming a whole lot of gaming.
It's going to cost Guillaume $100 a megabyte to play Beyond the Beyond.
Yeah, it's really, really not that interesting. Like, it sounds good on paper, but these are features I'll never use.
Yeah, I mean, U.S. has really shitty internet in some places. It just does.
Well, yeah, I mean, but this is Sony. They engineer stuff that's usually about 10 years ahead of when anybody wants it.
If they ever
that's
want
what
it
they do.
At all.
And it's like, Sony is an interesting company because they make some really, really, really cool shit that really, really, really nobody wants.
And see, Microsoft does that too, but what Microsoft doesn't do is they don't put it on sale.
Yeah.
They go like, look at the shit we made. It's really awesome.
Yeah.
And people are like, yeah, that's great.
The original Surface, that giant table.
That was the best thing I've ever seen at
like,
E3.
Played that Ubisoft like, war game.
Like in Japan, in Japan, the PSP had a camera that you could bolt onto the top of it.
Oh, that's right, it did!
That blows my mind. Why? Why would you have that? And it had like
because
had
people
like,
love Game Boy Camera.
It had like a GPS program on it.
It did.
It just blows my
and
mind. It's like that stuff. It's like cool. Every console
why
is like a
Vita
science
have 3G?
Project.
John, why does Vita have 3G?
Why are they patenting 4G? Because 3G apparently was I don't know. Maybe it was getting overused. Maybe it was getting overused and they exhausted the bandwidth. I don't know.
Oh, man. Anyway, it cracks me up. But overall, I mean, I didn't actually see it. I followed the whole thing through Twitter. But I felt Sony's announcements were mostly impressive. I mean, I thought the ideas were impressive. I don't know about the games. I haven't actually seen the game videos yet.
Neither have we, so
a lot of people didn't seem all that excited about the stuff that they showed in terms of the games. But
yeah,
this wasn't really about the games. I was actually surprised that they showed any games for this thing. I think we'll see a lot more about that at E3. And this is just kind of a nice little extra preview of that kind of stuff.
But yeah.
Overall, I think it sounds really cool. I mean, I don't know that it's going to be affordable for me or even appealing to me in any kind of near term. But it was exciting, you know, especially in February. You don't really expect to get that kind of avalanche of information about a new console.
So I mean, I'm really looking forward to the E3 unveiling of Home 2.0. That's what I'm really looking forward to.
I was really upset we didn't get to hear about Home because I want a place where I know that if I walk into some dude's house, he's probably watching pornography on his fake TV screen.
Yeah, and his avatar is a girl who stares 1,000 yards
the share button.
Like a zombie.
The one unintended
at
effect.
Home.
The one unintended effect of some of the facts that we learned recently is that it made Nintendo's handling of transferring content seem just like, you know, a gift from the gods or something. Because apparently the PS4, you cannot transfer any PSN content to PS4.
Yeah,
because
I don't get that at all.
Because it's not compatible with the PS3.
Yeah, totally, and I understand that now, but I just...
But you can play it over the clouds!
Well, that's the thing, though. That's the thing.
What?
You won't be able
to
transfer
though.
It, but they will. Those games will stay on your PSN account, right?
Yeah, but...
So you
like, you'll be able to
play
them. Get to them in some way, I'm sure.
Well, you'll be able to play them on the PS3, but that's the thing. Like, you know, that plan doesn't involve at all me buying a PS4. I could just keep playing them on the PS3. So
if your main concern is continuing to play PS3 games, then I'm pretty sure that PS3 will continue to be your best bet.
Yeah,
but also like
probably
it kind
only
of throws
plan on
a
buying
wrench.
A PS4 if you want to play PS4 games.
No, I know, but like, doesn't make you kind of wonder. Because I don't know what exactly I was expecting, but you look at Steam and your games are pretty much compatible for
forever. PC games.
Yeah,
I mean it's PC. PC goes. I could play Lords of the Realm 2, a game from 1997, on my Windows 7 machine.
But people, you know, bitched about Wii Mode and the Wii U as if that's the worst thing in the world. Nintendo not giving us these features. For these games
that
we transferred, but at least
those people are crazy. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
Well,
I think the implementation could be better, but you know, I would never take backwards compatibility for granted. And
I
want to
see
Iwata
get up and talk about the cloud. I just want it, please, please.
Anyway, I don't know. Guys, I guess. Yeah.
Well, if you have opinions on backwards compatibility, maybe you should throw them in the forums.
You should throw them in the forums because that's where we don't go.